Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now, 210-599-5555.
All right. Well, a very good morning. Kind of a wet morning, not really raining very much, just enough to make the streets pretty wet out there, just kind of a little drizzle. Seems to be spread pretty much all the way across South Texas, but it was coming down a little bit up in Bernie, but here in San Antonio, fairly dry, but supposed to be that kind of day. At least it's warm out there. Gonna have probably several more fairly warm days. Well, a couple more pretty warm days, and then Tuesday morning, gonna be chilly again. Up in the hill country, you better cover those tomatoes if you're gambling and putting them in early. San Antonio shouldn't be a problem, though, and should be great for all those spring flowers you're planting, like Gerber daisies and zinnias and all that sort of thing. And it's just going to be a very good day out there. Hope you're going to get out and enjoy, because it's gonna be spring here before we know it. And unfortunately, after we have spring, then summer comes along, and I don't think any of us are ready for that quite yet. Interesting. Got somebody named July waiting to talk. Actually, second in line, so I guess that goes along real well with summertime. But lots of folks up early this morning. Let's see here. It looks like we've got Kim and July and Bobby and Julie. Wonder if that's supposed to be Julie up there. Anyway, we'll get right on with phone calls, because I just hate to keep people waiting. Lots of things to talk about today, lots of fun things, but what is most important to me is what is on your mind. So we start out with Kim. Good morning, Kim.
I have a question. Last fall, I bought a Japanese maple.
Okay.
And it looked really bad. I got it on a deep, deep discount because it was half dead. Because it had been such a rough summer, and this is like a wholesale nursery that also does some retail.
Uh-huh.
And I thought it was such a deep discount, I thought it was worth buying it and trying to save it.
And besides, you were rescuing it from apparently a very bad home, so
exactly.
Good for you. So,
well, I decided the first thing was to repot it in the same size pot, but just like give it some fresh soil. And they had put at least of like the slow release fertilizer in there.
Osmocote,
like, oh,
yeah.
Oh, yep. My gosh, that is like way too much fertilizer. So The thing could have been dying from over-fertilization. But I tried to get as much off as I could without like really disturbing the roots, because it was in rough shape. So I've overwintered it, and it's outside, and I've seen more die back. Like it started dying back. There's a lot more stuff that looked like it was alive and now looks dead. But I do see a few little things look like they might sprout out. I'm wondering, at what point should I take it back out and maybe soak it in some super thrive and get rid of all that fertilizer? Because there's still a lot in there, I'm sure.
Yeah, I wouldn't worry too much about it at this point. The one thing about that type of fertilizer, it is very temperature sensitive as far as how much fertilizer it releases. Probably had a lot to do with why the plant was doing poorly, because last summer when it was so hot, it was getting a whole lot more fertilizer than it needs. And is this stuff the stuff that's kind of clear to amber color, looks like little BBs?
Yeah.
Okay,
yes.
Yeah, that's called osmocote is what it's called.
Oh, yeah.
And but once weather cools down, the release slows down, so there's very little fertilizer being released right now. But I suspect that in the heat last summer, it just got fried from having, like you said, way too much fertilizer. But at this point, I wouldn't worry about it, because like I say, it's probably most of the fertilizer was used up last summer, and this time of year when the soil is chilly, it's not releasing that much fertilizer to begin with. So at this point, what you've got to try to do is get some good new roots on that plant. And Super Thrive, Garrett Juice, those are the things that will help. I would, I wouldn't worry about taking it out of the pot and trying to soak it, but I would very much soak it from the top down. In fact, you might even use Garrett Juice and Super Thrive together, but use that to water the plant very thoroughly. Do that, at least every other watering for the next couple of months. Now, since it doesn't have much, if any, foliage on it yet, it's not going to need water very often. It's not going to dry out till it gets some leaves on it. But at this point, I would just sort of, give it good care, sit back, wait, and see where it comes out. Now, in addition to putting your Super Thrive Garrett Juice on the root system, I would mix up a little spray bottle of it, and I would spray the top of the plant with it, and I would do that regularly. I'd do that every few days until it really starts getting good foliage on it. But at this point, I think it may surprise you. Japanese maples, they're sensitive to a lot of things. Their foliage is very, very tender, and it doesn't take a lot to make the foliage look really bad, but that's not necessarily a sign that the plant is unhealthy. So at this point, let's just give it good care until it puts out its spring growth. Then we can see what's alive, what's dead, trim it appropriately, and move forward from there. This time of year, it can actually take as much sun as you want to give it. When we get into hotter weather, you'll need to move it to a shadier spot. But the plant just needs some roots. So let's don't shock it any more than it already is pulling it out of the pot or anything else. And at this point, some good care and some patience is what is in order.
So those, that osmocote, how can you tell when it's, does it just disappear when it's gone?
No, it will get to the point that it's a dry fertilizer coated with several coats of walnut oil, and those little and to me they're BBs, the size of double-aught buckshot probably. Mm-hmm. And they will get to the point where they're just hollow. That little coating is going to stay there, for years probably. But I'd be willing to bet obviously this plant was probably potted, when last summer started, and it just flat got fried because they put way too much of the fertilizer in there, and the soil got really, really hot. So I suspect if you go back to wherever you dump the things that you took out of there and you squeeze some of those little things, you'll find that they just kind of crumble, that they don't have, mm-hmm. Much liquid, much less any dry inside. So, it's not a fertilizer that I recommend at all. And the reason is, it's, number one, it's not organic, but number two, it's just, its release is so irregular. It gives your plants virtually nothing in the winter and gives them way too much in the summer months. And, if this was a, grower, retailer, they obviously have a lot to learn about growing plants. But
well, they're not actually growing them. They're they're like a wholesale nursery.
Okay,
they
so they're re-wholesaling is they're re-wholesaling yes. is what they're doing. They're buying from a bigger nursery somewhere. Yeah.
And when I went to buy, I asked how much it was, and they told me it was $180.
Yeah.
I just laughed and I walked away. Then they chased me out the door and said, "Wow!" And she went over and said, because they said that they were on sale, and they sold it to me for $40. And I thought I would just take a chance,
Well, yeah, that's worth giving it a try. And I would not be at all surprised if it comes out and does just fine for you. This time of year, in fact, through the winter months, Japanese maples, if they're at all stressed, they look crummy. The leaves don't, you know, fall off like they normally would in the winter months, and it's not going to change in appearance very much until it starts budding out this spring, which if the weather stays warm, are you here in this area or where are you calling me from?
I'm in Austin.
Okay. Yeah, it's if the weather stays the way it is right now, that plant may start budding out for you in, you know, next 2 or 3 weeks, and you're going to be able to tell a whole lot more about it. It's kind of like a grafted fruit tree. Many varieties, if not most, Japanese maples are grafted, so you're going to need to watch it very carefully, and anything that appears to be coming out at ground level, cut it off, because that's probably coming from the rootstock. It could be cutting grown. It's possible that it's not grafted. It's possible that it is cutting grown.
Okay. I can see the graft because it's on a, it's one of the, it's a red dragon, maybe something.
Okay.
I don't, it's one of the dwarfer, you know, because I bought it to leave it in a pot because I know I wanted to be able to get it out of the full stack.
Sure. The one precaution I would give you, and this is sort of tell you it's not your fault if it doesn't do well, but it's possible, depending on where this re-wholesaler bought that plant, it could be grafted onto sugar maple rootstock, which is not going to be happy in Austin. But hopefully it's not. Hopefully it's grafted on Big Tooth or on a maple that will do well here. So it's not out of the woods. It may just, you know, may need to be rehomed to somebody in Michigan or something like that. But at this point, you know, just give it good care and be patient with it. You know, you will not have to water very often since there are no leaves, but mist the top of it. Well, water the top of it, you know, spray the top of it, but mist it frequently with water with a little Garrett juice and a little bit of Super Thrive in there, and you'll be giving it every chance.
Okay. I know that the who grew it is Monrovia.
Okay, well, that came out of Oregon probably, and okay. They're a good grower. You know, you've got a good plant. They ought to know better than to put that much osmocote in the bottom of the pot, but I guess they're in a much colder climate, so they can get away with it. But, no, if it's from Monrovia, they have a California and an Oregon location, and they're good growers. You know, they produce good quality trees. It just got some bad care and a bad home somewhere along the way. So at this point, you know, you've done just about all you can other than the Garrett juice and Super Thrive. So water it with that about, make it every other watering that you give it, you know, the Super Thrive and Garrett juice and water combination. But put some of that in a spray bottle, and just every time you think about it, pick it up and just mist the top of the plant with it. And probably 2-3 weeks from now, we're going to have a real good idea of how much of it's going to come out. And you're welcome to call me back anytime, but call me back in a couple of weeks and let me know how it's doing.
Okay. One last question. When can I repot? Because I have a ceramic pot it's just in the nursery pot that I bought it in, next fall replant it?
It shouldn't really be replanted until it's root bound. And that's going to take a while. And is it possible just to set the nursery container, some people call them grow pots, can you just set that down inside of your ceramic pot? Maybe put some moss or some bark around it to make it look better?
Do something. It's like, I'm not worried about that. I just wanted to know, like, I don't want to freak it out again.
I certainly wouldn't do that. And again, you're going to make it much heavier to move when you replant it into that ceramic pot, and it may take a little while to figure out where it's going to be happiest. So don't be anxious to turn that 20-pound plant into a 90-pound plant. And like I say, the only two times to replant a plant are, number one, if it's root-bound, drying out so quickly you can't keep it properly watered, or if it's gotten so top-heavy you can't keep it standing upright. Those are the only two times to repot a plant, unless it's just in horrible soil, in which case you probably bare root it and start all over with it. But this one, Monrovia, uses probably better growing mix than most Texas nurseries do, so I wouldn't worry about trying to replace the soil. You've done the good thing getting rid of the excess soil.
I used some Fox Farm, so it's in good soil now.
Good.
So, all right.
Well,
thank you so much.
I'm going to give it a whole lot better chance than I think you started out with. I think it's probably going to turn out pretty well for you.
Well, keep my fingers crossed.
Very good, Kim. Thank you for the call this morning. Goodbye. All right. Well, now that we have a name corrected, I know it's Julie that I'm going to be talking to next. Good morning, Julie.
Good morning, Bob. This is Julie from Oklahoma.
Yes, ma'am.
And, I have two kind of short ones I wanted to ask you about, and then one I'll just hang up and let you lecture us on them. But is it time to get the little wasps that come on the tabs that you put on the trees? Is it time to get those out, or is it too early?
It's certainly time to do it in Texas. I think you're probably a couple of weeks early in Oklahoma.
Okay.
It's are y'all still having frost with some regularity?
Oh, yeah. Well, this week we haven't, but I don't trust that.
Well, you know, I know for next us, next Monday night is supposed to be chilly here, which means it's probably going to be really chilly for you guys. But when you get past the danger of a hard freeze or really okay. heavy frost, then that's probably going to be the time to do it. And I'm going to guess for you it's going to be in about 2 weeks. Here in South Texas, yeah, it's warming up to where probably a good idea to get them out. But where you are, give it a couple of weeks, and then we'll see what the weather does.
Now, the name of those, are they these trichoderma?
Yes.
Trichogramma. Okay.
Trichoderma is the fungus. Trichogramma is the wasp. And the people just to avoid stumbling around on the word, a lot of people just call them the tea wasps, and everybody knows what they're talking about.
Okay. And then the other thing I wanted to ask you about. Okay, I've written that down. I'm going to wait then on that. Okay. A couple of weeks ago, you had mentioned to somebody, you were talking about oak leaf hydrangeas that they're beautiful plants, but their blooms are kind of weak.
They're different, shall we say. They don't open many flowers at one time. They open the flowers over a period of time, and anybody that's ever seen the big, pinks and blues. Anybody's ever been to San Francisco or, somewhere like that where these things are really, really happy? The oak leaf looks a little faded out, but it has the benefit that it's not nearly as picky about its soil. It's much more cold hardy. You can grow oak leaf hydrangeas in a lot wider range of climates than you can grow your big floral hydrangeas.
Okay, well, Bob, I was wondering, now, this is going to sound weird, but could you kind of cheat to make them bloom more if you fertilize them with bloom stuff, like, every 2 weeks?
No.
No. Okay.
It'll make the plants happier, probably, but it's just the nature of that type of hydrangea.
Okay.
It's just, they call it a lace cap hydrangea is the broad generic term they use, and it just never opens more than about 5%, at most 10% of the blooms on that head at any one time. I guess it would be an umbel, probably, would be the term for the flower. But it blooms over a much longer period of time. That head of buds is going to give you color probably for a couple of months, where the big fancy ones, they're going to fade out after a couple of weeks. So they have their place, most definitely, but if you'd never had prime rib, you'd think hamburger tasted really good.
Okay. All right. And are they one of the ones that need that 6 to 8 hours of full sun?
They will tolerate more full sun, but no, they don't need it, and they I would not give them any afternoon sun. Morning sun is fine. You're obviously a little cooler than we are in South Texas, but your July sun can get pretty darn hot and baking, so I would not put it where it gets any summer hot sun. Probably up till 10 or 11 is okay, but they also thrive and bloom, in pretty good shade, which is what makes them a little more attractive to a lot of people as well.
Okay, and then the third thing is, I can just hang up and you can just talk about this, but I'm trying to get myself ready for summer again. I mean, last summer was just intense over the whole everywhere, you know. Mm-hmm. And have you given a lot of thought to, is there something special that we, just a normal gardener, can get ready for maybe another intense summer?
And that's a good question. Don't hang up, because I may want to ask a little bit more of you. But you know very well about mulching things for the winter to protect them from the cold. We also mulch things for the summer, because it's you know, it's kind of like down or anything else. It keeps the old joke about the Aggie and the thermos. It keeps hot things hot and cold things cold. Mulch will keep the soil cooler. And we won't go to that joke. I don't want to offend any of my A&M friends. But the mulch keeps the soil cooler in the summer, just like it keeps it warmer in the winter. You don't want to pile it up around the trunk, but out over the root system, mulch will very definitely help. Probably the other things just to realize, and you probably do, but be sure that you're allowing things to dry properly between waterings. And that sounds silly, but when it gets real hot, things lots of times droop, and people look at those droopy leaves and say, oh, it needs water, and they go out and water, and they end up drowning the poor plants, because a lot of things, when we have a summer like last summer, they're just drooping from the heat. They're not drooping because they need water, and water's the last thing you want to put on a plant in that situation. The other thing, and obviously you can't do this for your whole garden, but you can give things that seem to be have a tendency to burn, you can give them a little bit more shade. You can use that same insulate fabric we use to protect from cold. You can put some of that over them. That will reduce the amount of sun. You can actually get some shade cloth if you have a bigger area that you think is just getting too much sun. You know, a fairly thin shade cloth, like a 30% or 40% or something like that. I've got a big section.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you, that, the percentage. Okay, good.
Yeah, I'm glad you here's one thing about sunburn. It's a function of leaf temperature. And you can go out and just with your thumb and forefinger feel the temperature of that leaf. If it feels hot to the touch, it's probably getting ready to sunburn, and you ought to do something to, you know, keep it from getting as much sun. If it feels cool, and you're going to find that plants that are better adapted to bright sun, even in the on the hottest day, that leaf will feel cool just from the transpiration, from the water vapor it's giving off. So, you know, you can tell whether a plant's getting ready to burn. And giving them a little protection from the hot sun is very definitely going to help. And, you know, beyond that, just water properly, meaning water very thoroughly when you water. And then, like you say, don't go by the appearance of the plants. Feel that soil. Don't water again until that soil is dry a good inch deep. And then give it another very thorough watering. But those are the main things. You mulch over the root zone, but not the stems, and a little bit of shade cloth. That's going to help things get through the summer, even if it does turn out to be another scorcher, as my grandmother used to say.
Yeah. Well, thank you, because that was, I mean, I don't want it to happen, but I also, I was so frustrated. Everybody was frustrated last summer.
including your nurseryman friends and the growers and everybody else, because it was a tough summer. And just keep in mind, plants have what is called the compensation point, and that's how much energy it takes that plant just to stay alive, to perform its basic metabolic functions. You know, it's just there's a certain amount of nutrition you need to stay alive, but then there's how much you need if you're an active gardener, hiker, whatever. And plants are the same way. And when the compensation point gets really high, they're just hanging on to survive, and they don't have anything left over to grow and bloom and, you know, give you the beauty that you planted them for. So you have to be a little understanding and patient with them, because they don't like that heat any more than you do, and they're just simply not physically capable of rewarding you the way they normally would, when it's just taking everything they have just to, keep their temperature down and just survive the heat. So, have to be a little patient with things. But then again, there are things that absolutely love this hot sun. I mean, in hot summer, bougainvilleas thrived in it. Periwinkles thrived in it. Lantana, they didn't care if it was 110 degrees and baking heat. They just got spectacular. So,
I was so grateful for my lantana last summer because that's what I had. That's all I had.
Yeah, well, lantana, salvia greggii, bougainvilleas, oxoras, they're plenty of tropical things out there. Copper plants were spectacular last summer, and there are lots of new varieties. So, you know, kind of use your own judgment, and if you feel like it looks like it's going to be a super hot summer, plant accordingly, and you'll just really make your neighbors look bad.
Thank you.
Very good. Well, it's always a pleasure talking to you, and I'll look forward to our next visit, Julie.
Okie doke. Thank you very much.
You're Bye-bye. Certainly welcome. Goodbye. All right, let's get Bobby in here before the news break. Good morning, Bobby.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
I have a $35,000 question for you.
Okay.
And I wasn't laughing when I saw that figure. What I have is, I hesitate calling you because you're all about growing things, and I'm calling about maybe killing some things.
Okay, what are you trying to kill?
My home was built in 1960.
Uh-huh.
And I recall seeing, you showed me a picture of your own home, which is 100
built
years
in,
old.
Built in 1906. So, yeah.
Well, I figure maybe you might have come across the same problem. We have a sewer line. I live near the airport.
Mm-hmm.
And the area is called Harmony Hills.
Oh, I know Harmony Hills very well. Rhapsody Drive, Patricia mm-hmm. Drive. I know Harmony Hills. Had some good friends live out there. Silver Sands. If I went through it, I could probably name most of the streets in Harmony Hills.
Now, that's true. Street names are easy to remember. Again, it was built in 1960. About 2 to 3 years ago, and it was a funny thing. It was starting to happen when our drought started.
Mm-hmm.
I have a sewer line that forks, and one of the forks serves the utility room and the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
Water started backing up in the sink, kitchen sink, and mm-hmm. in the utility room. A couple of times I had a plumber come out to use an auger,
uh-huh.
and he did something real quick. That cleared it up for about 6 to 9 months, and then it happened again.
Mm-hmm.
So this third time, I called a plumber. I won't mention the name of the company. They advertise a lot, and they have a lot of trucks, so there's a lot of overhead with this company.
Right.
So he ran a camera, mm-hmm. a camera line through the sewer.
Bobby, let me do this. I'm right up on the news break, so I'm going to get Jimmy to put you back on hold, and I look forward to continuing this question, and we'll do it right after news here on KTSA Radio, San Antonio, Texas.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now, 210-599-5555.
All right, getting back to gardening, we're going to visit a little bit more with Bobby with his $35,000 question. I think I have an idea where that came from, and it looks like Don and Betty will be up immediately afterwards. But Bobby, we just gotten to the point of running a camera down the line.
Yes, sir. Probably after this call, I'll call the home improvement show and ask about gardening. But
good idea. Well, anyway, tell me what they found.
Right. In running the line, they found a lot of tree roots.
Mm-hmm. And not surprising.
There's an area in front of my patio, back patio, probably 4 or 5 feet by 10 feet, that I have that the sewer line runs underneath. Mm-hmm. And I have what I'm asking you about is really root systems.
Right.
The camera showed these roots that had infiltrated the sewer line.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the plants I have is a really old photinia. I think it's a red-tipped photinia.
Uh-huh.
It's very tall. Then I also have a mountain laurel. And then there's an older nandina. I know those roots are fairly invasive. Anyway, I have those three those are the three major plants that I have in that area where that sewer line runs. So my question is, and after I talked with this particular plumber, he did something on his iPad and showed me his estimate. And the estimate was $35,000.
That's crazy. That's crazy. Let me ask you a couple of questions. Do you have clay tile sewer pipe, or what is the pipe made out of in that area?
Well, I'm trying to think now what he called it. It was a.
Is it a plastic pipe, or is it a steel pipe, or
it's more of a steel pipe?
Okay,
metal pipe.
Okay, and do you have any idea how big it is? How many large in diameter it is?
I really don't. Okay. Except to look at the opening at the ground level. You know, it probably isn't more than about 6 inches, 7 inches.
Okay. Well, if it's that big, then there you have a lot of options. The problem is not really the plants. Any plant's roots. You pick any woody plant that you want to, whether it's an oak tree, whether it's a mount laurel, whether it's a pittosporum or photinia or a holly. That plant, its roots don't have little drills. They can't penetrate a piece of pipe that's in good shape. But if that pipe is worn out and there are holes in the pipe, doesn't matter what the plant is, it's going to put its roots into the area where it finds water and nutrients. And you can imagine what I go through with the old clay tile line that isn't real tight to begin with, running under a big mott of oak trees between my home and my septic tank. So you have a couple of different options. One thing you can do is, and I probably have to do this no more than about every 2 years. You know, I pay a plumber to come out and run his little snake down through there and clear out the roots, and I'm good for a while longer, and I'm not having to spend any huge amount of money at one time. It's a little bit more complex since your line makes a Y, or, you know, it branches. But in a lot of cases, if you have a big line, like a 6-inch line, a decent plumber can run a 5-inch piece of PVC inside that old 6-inch line and, just literally replace the old line without taking it out of the ground. Now, you would have to dig up at the area that that the line makes a Y, part of it going to one part of your house, part of it to the other, and hopefully that's not underneath your patio there. That would be a problem, and that would require some tunneling to get to. But there are other options. There are things, unfortunately, some of them pretty poisonous, that you can put down the line that will retard the growth, you know, of roots into the line. It's not, you know, you've got to get out what's there, and that's what that little sharp metal thing that spins around that's on the end of his long thing that he runs down. And if he's a good plumber, he ran it down from what's called the clean out, where the line goes into your house. And then perhaps they actually chiseled the new spot of my line toward the other end so that they could run it back and forth in both directions. So that sounds like a lot of money to me, and I can't believe that it should cost that much. But there are other options. But you have to know how big that line is. If it's a metal line, you know, there's no fixing it. But it may certainly be possible. And I do a lot of things myself, but when it comes to sewer work, I dig out and expose the line, and that saves me about 2/3 of the cost of the repair when the plumber comes out and says, I don't have to bring in a backhoe, I don't have to do this, that, and the other. And if they do have to do any, you know, major digging, if it's around plants that you value that you don't want to disturb the root system on, have them dig with an air spade, not a backhoe, not even a shovel, and you may have to call an arborist to get somebody with an air spade, but This is what I recommend to people that are putting in low voltage lighting or putting in, you know, maybe replacing a broken sprinkler line or something like that where they don't want to dig it up. You get out there with an air spade and you can dig a trench practically as fast as you can with a shovel without doing nearly the damage to the roots and things like that. So depending on how big your line is and a couple of other factors, I would be in hopes that they could dig up, expose that Y, and basically, you know, cut out a little 18-inch section of pipe, which they're going to replace. But if they're replacing it with a heavy-duty PVC like Schedule 20 or something like that, most plumbing is Schedule 40 is what goes in the line. And if you got a lousy sprinkler system company, they use Schedule 200, which is really thin-walled. But if they are able to simply, you know, run a big enough line, which probably 4-inch minimum, but a big enough line to carry the load from your household plumbing. Again, golly, I'm not playing plumber, but I've dug a lot of lines and replaced a lot of plumbing. But from where it Ys and one portion goes to one part of your house and the other to the other, do both of these eventually service a toilet? Or does one of them in the principal part of your house go to your bathroom, to the toilet, and the other simply goes to, you know, a washer or a, you know, laundry room or something like that where it's basically just wastewater that's going down the system? Do you know?
Yes, I do know. One line serves one end of the house, which has the bathrooms and so forth. The other line serves the kitchen.
Okay.
And so it's definitely a fork.
Yeah, well, the line that serves the kitchen, you can get by with a much smaller pipe. A 3-inch pipe is probably all you would need there, and that's pretty cheap comparatively. And it just requires the proper fittings. But I would see if it's possible. And remember, you don't have to replace the whole thing. Once you get underneath your slab, there's not going to be any tree roots underneath your slab. The problem starts outside the slab. So if they can go from this Y simply up to and under the slab, then you've got everything you need to do as far as fixing the line. And then, of course, from the Y out to the city sewer pipe, again, you're going to have you know, a 5 or 6 inch line to carry the solids, as they like to put it. So anyway, there are a lot of other possibilities, and I hope I've given you a little bit of an education on that, and you'll know the proper questions to ask when you call a different plumbing company.
Well, the reason I called you is, well, with your expertise about root systems, and one option to me was, I'm not really sentimental about these three plants, these three trees. I have so many more in our back and front yard, you know, that's, you know.
But let me tell you this.
About cutting them down.
Okay, if you have three plants. Do you have a tree that you like within 50 feet of the sewer line?
No.
Okay, because trees from a long way away are going to grow their roots down into that area, and believe it or not, even grass could become a problem putting its roots down into that line. Uh-oh. So eliminating the plants is not really going to solve your problems. Because it's amazing. I mean, tree roots go under streets. Tree roots go under driveways. And it's amazing how one tiny little root, they're sort of feeling their way through the soil, so to speak. And when they hit the mother load, which is a leaky sewer line, they're going to grow through the crack, the opening in it, and really proliferate. And that's what causes your problem. So that's a Band-Aid to take those plants out. It's not going to fix the problem, and ultimately you're going to have other roots get in there and continue to cause more problems. So, labor's the most important, expensive part of plumbing, but I would tell you, if they are able to put, you know, a pipe inside a pipe, so to speak, you're looking easily at less than $500 worth of materials, probably less than $300 worth of materials to take care of this problem. Beyond that, you got plenty of labor. It's going to pile up on top of that, but $35,000, I think not.
Mm-hmm. Well, that, yes, and he, including that estimate, he included changing out the home was built in 1960, so sure. Changing out some of the plumbing in the utility room, but that's not giving me the problem. Okay. Thank you. That gives me a second okay. option.
And do you understand the things I was telling you about doing there?
Yes, I do. I do. I hear you.
You're well armed now, so get back with them and, feel free to call me if you have more questions. That's what I'm here for.
Okay, sure do. Yeah, sure will. Thanks a lot, Bob.
You're sure welcome. Thank you. Let's see. Gosh, I better get a break in here. My next two callers are Don and Betty. You know, I always hope when we have a question takes a little bit longer like that, everybody learns something. And so, sure, I gave Bobby a little extra time, and hopefully you learned something from his question as well. Let's do a break, and like I say, then I'll get back to Don and Betty. Looks like I get to talk to you about my friends at Adams, the folks who make the Nature's Creation products. Nature's Creation makes a lot of quality products, organic products, natural products, nothing synthetic. And they've got some great things. One of the things that a lot of people want to do this time of year is put out a pre-emergent herbicide. I'm not huge on pre-emergents, but I absolutely will tell you, you do not want a chemical pre-emergent, a synthetic pre-emergent, because that's going to mess up your trees and cause all sorts of other problems. But if you want a good one, what you want is corn gluten meal, CGM as we call it. Well, Nature's Creation has a spreadable form of corn gluten meal. It's pelletized to the point that you can put it out with a regular spreader, and it will do a lot to stop all the winter weeds that want to start coming up this time of year. Plus, it's a good fertilizer. The spreadable corn gluten meal, you get small packages, large packages. You're perfectly safe to use it in the garden, on your lawn. Pre-emergents don't totally solve the problem of weeds in the yard. But if you want a good pre-emergent, and I would certainly suggest that you combine it with a little bit of the good compost from Nature's Creation, but this spreadable corn gluten meal, which you'll find at many fine nurseries around the area, that's your answer. You do not want the synthetic stuff that a lot of people sell, because it is highly toxic and will damage plants that you don't want to damage. Nature's Creation makes quality products. You'll find their products wherever fine gardening products are sold, places like Fanix, like Rainbow Gardens. Most every feed store out in the country carries their products, as do Milburgers, and we certainly have lots of things here at Shades of Green. Remember that spreadable corn gluten meal, and even more importantly, remember Nature's Creation.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening. Don and Betty are my next two callers. Don's up first. Good morning, Don.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
I've got a question for you. It's been a while since I've talked to you. I went on vacation.
Lucky you.
No, it wasn't. Put this way, I call it a vacation because it sounds better.
Yeah.
And they said we had 12 inches of rain while I was at vacation. And I'm dealing with about four of those. I think they call them weedsatch, the one that makes those great big old thorns about 3 inches long and produces yellow flowers.
That could be weedsatch, that could be Rotama, what they call Parkinsonia, goes by a number of different names, but they're all woody trees. What's happening or not happening with them?
Okay, it's in my gardening area, and I cut them down last year, and now we had all this rain. I went out with my regrowth plow and tried to plow them under, and they have roots the size of fruit cans.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
A single root. My question is, because I've been digging around them, and pulled the tops off of them, so it's easier for me to mess with, because all the thorns are coming out now. Mm-hmm. You remember how we used to cut off trees and then drill holes and
right.
put, like, diesel in them? Could I do that to that one single root, and it kill the entire root?
It would probably kill the whole root, but that may not be the only root that tree has going down. You can do that to the stump. You can also put potassium nitrate, what they call stump remover, in there that will rot the stump. And if you cut it back repeatedly, you know, you will ultimately kill it. But, they're survivors. They're trees that can put up with an awful lot and still grow. If it's Wisatch, it probably froze to the ground two winters ago and has come back out. The Parkinsonia may or may not have, but you need to expose as much of it as possible. Cut it off if you want to as far below ground as you possibly can. And like I say, if you cut it back repeatedly, it'll resprout three or four times before it gives up and dies. Or you can drill further down into the stump, further down into the root, and you know, put your choice of materials in that root. I use the so-called stump remover, and it causes the roots to deteriorate fairly quickly. But short of digging it out with a backhoe, that's about all you're going to be able to do.
Yeah, and it's not all that I have access to a backhoe anymore.
Yeah.
That's why I'm kind of looking at, because I've gone about 2 feet into it, and I mean, it's a great big old single-rooted device, and I was thinking about taking my cordless drill and a paddle bit and drill it about four holes in it. And
sure.
I did it with a mesquite tree where I actually got it back to the big main roots and drilled it, mm-hmm. and I just poured gasoline on it.
I wouldn't do gasoline. Gasoline is a little dangerous, and it evaporates so quickly it's probably not going to do much of anything. But diesel would probably kill it, followed up with some molasses to, you know, get rid of the diesel, but that would probably kill it.
Yeah, because I'm trying to figure out the easiest way to do it without hurting my back anymore.
Well, sure. And one thing that a lot of people don't realize, and it's a mistake I made, but I've always remembered, you know, what my friend told me, if you're going to cut these trees down and ultimately want to get rid of them, unless you're going to do something like you're talking about, don't cut them off at ground level. If you're going to have a friend that happens to have a backhoe or something like that come over, leave that stump sticking up 3-4 feet out of the ground so they have something to get a hold of. I was building a road one time, and you know, I thought I was doing the guy a favor cutting the cedar down right to ground level. And he said, it's a whole lot easier for me if you leave that trunk sticking up 3 or 4 feet, because then I've got something to get the bucket around or get a chain around or whatever else, and I can pull it out of the ground. So go about it however you think. But if you're ultimately hoping to pull those things out, don't cut them off all the way to the ground.
Well, problem is when they came up, there was about 15 shoots off each one, and they were sized of like 1-inch pipe, and the easiest way for me to deal with it was to go out there with a pole saw, not a chainsaw, mm-hmm. go in there with a pole saw, get in there and cut them all loose so I don't get all tore up, and put that in the burn pile, because that's what I'm doing this weekend, is burning off brush piles.
Well, and it's a pretty good weekend to do that, but keep in mind, if you had gotten to it early, those little shoots that come off the base like you're describing, they are very weakly attached, and you could probably, with nothing more than your foot, you could have broken them off and stripped them away from the base, and you'd be a whole lot further along toward getting rid of it. So the stuff that sprouts off the bottom is, like I say, the wood fibers parallel, and it's pretty easy to break away. If you cut it off, you're just probably making the problem worse in the long run. But you know what you're doing. Get out there with your paddle bit and drill down into those big roots and do whatever you think best to kill them.
Yeah, because this year I don't think I would be growing out there. Other things have came up, and it's easier to help the neighbors. It is for me to do what I got to do.
Well, you get out there and do it, and have a good day, and get ready. It will be a perfect day across most of South Texas to burn some of those brush piles with this kind of drizzly rain. Not going to be enough to put your fire out, but it's going to be enough to keep the grass and things around from spreading. So I think you got your work cut out for you, Don. And I appreciate the call. And, Jimmy, let's see what Betty's up to this morning. Good morning, Betty.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay. Are you ready, Bob?
it's been an interesting morning. That's what makes this fun, is you get such a diversity of questions. So what are you going to hit me with today?
Well, I have two questions, so don't let me forget about the second one. But number one, and the biggie, is my sprinkler system has not worked in over 5 years, and I'm considering getting it, I don't know, replaced, reinstalled, fixed, and I was.
Are you in San Antonio? Where are you?
I'm in the county near Leon Springs.
Okay. Call S.A. Rainmaker. Talk to Bill.
Okay.
I imagine they come that far out, and I can tell you they're honest. They're not going to overcharge you. And if something just needs to be replaced, they will tell you. They're not, believe me, these guys have plenty of business, and they're not out to sell you something you don't need, but, I've only known them for 35 or 40 years, and they've solved many a problem for me over the years, so,
I know I have a lot of broken off heads, and they're probably old style, and I didn't know if there was something, but I should look for in that.
Well, get them to come out and take a look at it. And like I say, you can trust them. If they tell you it needs to be replaced, it needs to be replaced. If they can simply replace some heads and probably need to put a new controller on it, that's what they'll do. It costs a lot of money to dig trenches and put pipes in. It doesn't cost nearly as much to replace heads, and then $100 or $2, you got a good controller, you're in good shape. But unless, you know, that, I guess what I'm just telling you is they're trustworthy people. They're not going to. They're not going to take your money unless it can't be fixed. They're not going to replace it if they can't fix it, and they can fix an awful lot.
Okay. Well, I'm not getting any younger, and I'm tired of dragging the hose around.
I can understand that.
Unless it doesn't work.
Right.
Your second question.
Yeah.
Okay. I have a candlestick tree, cinna, whatever.
Yeah.
Probably 5 years ago, and I saved some seeds. Mm-hmm. And now I don't know whether you think those seeds are viable, and I want the Garrett juice. I have Garrett juice plus.
Uh-huh, that's fine. Yeah.
Okay, how do I dilute that to soak them?
You're not going to need a lot of water, probably a cup of water, and I just put maybe a teaspoon of Garrett juice in a cup of water. If you want to do a little bit more, if you're doing a pint, put a tablespoon of Garrett juice in there, and don't over soak them. Give them about 10 or 15 minutes, and that should do the job. Where have the seeds been stored? Have they been in an envelope? They've been in the refrigerator?
Oh, of course not. In the garage, in the heat.
Well, there's no way to know, until you plant them and see. That is an interesting plant. It is a hardy plant, usually an annual in this area, but if you want a plant that, you know, grows 5 or 6 feet tall and gives you brilliant yellow flowers and it'll stand up to the heat and the drought and everything else, Empress candlestick is a pretty good choice.
Right. It's so pretty.
And
then I was going to ask too, I have one of the orange Esperanzas, the smaller ones.
Right.
Could I plant it near there? Would that make a good combination, or is that not a good
idea? It would be a pretty combination, but, you know, give your Esperanza room. Plant your candlestick at least 3 feet away from where your Esperanza is, and Esperanza should be perennial. The candlestick will be an annual and probably have to be replaced every year, but grows easily from seed, grows quickly. It sounds like you may be thinking about planting it now in a pot and, you know, getting your little plants up to a decent size. You can certainly do that now and plant out in the yard as soon as we're past the danger of a hard freeze.
I just love experimenting with seeds.
Oh, yeah, it's fun. But next time, put those seeds in a paper envelope, put that envelope in a mason jar, and put it in the refrigerator. Yep.
I hear you, but I do what I do. Do what I say, not what I do.
That's my line.
I know it. I've listened to you long enough to know that.
Oh, I appreciate it, Betty. You get out and have a wonderful weekend.
All righty. Thank you, Bob.
It's my pleasure. Thank you. All right, need to get a break in here. Do have some open lines. Grab one of them if you like. 599-5555, 210 area code, of course. I get to talk to you about Southwest Metal Roofing Systems, and one of the reasons I know a little bit about a lot of different things is I talk to good people. I talk to good plumbers. I talk to good carpenters, and I know about good roofs, too. And Southwest Metal Roofing Systems, well, they're the best of the best for a lot of reasons. They use the best quality metal out there, a good lifetime quality metal. Just as equally as important is the quality of the work they do. They install roofs pretty much up to the standards you'd have to do down in hurricane country. Their roofs are made to last a lifetime. They give you the best warranty in the industry. as I say frequently, I've had one of the roofs on my home for over 20 years now and not called them once, not even once, with a single problem. We have one of the roofs on Shades of Green. My business partner, they have Southwest Metal Roofing Systems roof on their home. They're such good roofs. They're good looking. They're very reasonably priced, and they're going to save you money on your energy bill every month because they're so energy efficient. Plus, most homeowners insurance companies will give you a discount on your homeowners insurance because they know they're not going to have to come out and replace your roof. Learn more. There are lots of choices as far as color, as far as styles, and you can learn all about that by simply giving them a call at 210-822-6868. That's 210-822-6868 for Southwest Metal Roofing Systems.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 1071.
All right, let's get back to gardening and straight back to the phone lines. It's going to be Dave and Marie. Dave is first in line. Good morning, Dave.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
We had about 3 crowns and a visit to the dental surgeon up the road from you last fall, so there was no money for fertilizer or compost.
I understand that, yep.
So, what one would you do now?
Well, when was the last time you fertilized?
Last fall.
Okay.
Well, I put compost, I believe, and fertilizer a year ago this past fall.
Okay. You know, it's hard to say. Is your yard in good shape, or is your yard still struggling from the summer?
Most of it's pretty decent.
Okay. If the yard is in decent shape, I would just fertilize. If the yard is struggling, I'd skip the fertilizer and just do the compost. If it's a choice of one or the other, I just, you know, if it looks pretty good, compost benefits your yard for several years. And if your soil's really bad, if your yard's really struggling, yeah, doing compost every year would be a great idea. If your yard looks pretty good and seems to be doing fairly well, I think you could skip that labor and that expense and just, you know, put on a good organic fertilizer and, you know, look forward to a good spring.
And that was the correct answer because I didn't want to spread the compost.
Well, the honest the answer I give you is going to be the honest answer to the best of my knowledge, not what you want, because there are plenty of people that would rather not hear what I have to tell them. But in your case, I think if it were my yard, that's what I would do.
Is there such a thing as a summer rye? Someone was speaking to me yesterday about a summer ryegrass. Is there such a thing?
Do you live in Michigan? No. So
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's there are many cool season grasses, and South Texas does not have a cool summer season. So yeah, there are a lot of things that my friends in Wyoming can grow, that, you know, friends in the Northeast can grow, that you're just throwing your money away on down here. And ryegrass is not a summertime grass.
How soon would you put out the winter rye?
Normally, we start planting it in about October. I mean, if you're looking at pure mud, you can plant it right now. It's going to so-called perennial forms, which really aren't perennial, are definitely more heat tolerant. And if you planted today, you'd have green grass probably up until the middle of June or the 1st of July when it dies out. But where people are looking to overseed a yard for winter, depending on what the weather's doing, probably early October on up through the 1st of the year, you've got a pretty good planting window there.
Yeah, the last couple summers are making me consider just living with winter rye for, you know, 8 months out of the year and then letting it get ugly for the 4.
Well, there are other options, and in the heat you can always plant Bermuda from seed, which is pretty cheap and easy, but answer better still maybe to put in a ground cover. I can't see your yard, so I don't know. I can't give you you know, 100% of what I know will be an accurate answer, but I'm more in favor of perennials, of ground covers, things like that, because they use a third as much water or less, and they're a whole lot less maintenance once you get them established and growing. So I think everybody probably needs a little bit of grass for their kids and their pets. But most people have way too much of it, and they're, in my opinion, some much better options that take the summers better and don't break your back quite as much.
What kind of ground covers would you put in a fairly large?
If you want an evergreen ground cover, Asian jasmine, if you don't care if it goes away in the winter, there's a plant called dwarf plumbago or ceratostigma. It's not a plumbago at all. Its name is Ceratostigma plumbagioides, which means literally looks like plumbago, dark blue flowers. I think I watered mine twice all summer long. It goes away in the winter. It gets a pretty red color in the fall, dies down to ground level, but it comes back very dependably. And it just, I don't know, it's a wonderful plant, except for the fact it goes away in the winter. Blooms in the summer, it'll grow in the shade, it'll grow in the sun. I don't know of any insect pests that ever bother it. Even the deer don't like it very much. So dwarf plumbago is an outstanding ground cover. But like I say, you're going to be looking at bare dirt in the winter months. Of course, you could, you know, might throw a little bit of winter rye out over that. But, and then in things that are perennials that are not really ground covers, they're spreading lantanas. There are many different forms of salvia. There are, just a myriad of different flowers that are drought tolerant, from the five-nerge daisy to Zexmania. To the upright lantanas, to the list just goes on and on. So a lot of options to grass. They're a little bit more work to plant, but instead of, you know, being out there mowing it once a week, you're out there, you know, once a year cutting it back for the ones that freeze back and throwing a little fertilizer around now and then. But a perennial bed is a lot prettier and a whole lot less work than lawn.
Okay, very good. I think that answers my question.
Hey, it's always a pleasure talking to you. You get out and have a good weekend, and I hope your team wins. I have better things to do than sit in front of a TV on a beautiful Sunday this time of year, but I know an awful lot of my listeners out there are going to be tied to that tube. So if that's what you do, enjoy, and I know we'll talk again. And Marie, hang on just a second. Got to get one more break in here this hour. I get to talk to you for a moment about my friends at Kinetico. Yes, I know about water softeners because I've had a Kinetico in my home for many, many years. Actually, it's in my barn, but it services my laundry center and things like that. And Brad Messer talked me into checking out Kinetico many years ago. And I learned what I repeat to you on a regular basis, that there are two types of water softeners. One runs on electricity. One runs on the kinetic energy in the water. If you got electricity, you have the potential for problems with power outages. When you have a computer, so to speak, in your water softener, you have a potential for having something go wrong with that, with power surges and lightning strikes. Your kinetic doesn't have one of those either. It has a brain, so to speak, and it knows to only recharge when the rosin needs to be recharged. So it's not like that electronic model that's going to recharge on a preset schedule and waste a lot of salt, a lot of water, and a lot of money. I love my Kinetico. I'm sure you can tell that, and I highly recommend it to you if you're in the market for a water softener or a new water softener. Check out Kinetico. They'll even let you try it for 90 days before you pay for it. It's as easy as going to KineticoSA.com or giving them a call. Check out the water softener that I prefer, and that is a Kinetico.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening. Let's get straight back to the phone lines. I believe Marie is next in line. Good morning, Marie.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have several questions. I'll make it quick. So I live in the Fredericksburg area. And
okay.
3 years ago this spring, I planted two maple trees, a cadu and a big tooth.
Okay.
And they were only like 8 inches high. Got them from a reputable nursery. And one of them died. I don't know which one it was because I didn't label them. But
okay,
the other one has only grown to about a foot high. It's branched out a lot, but it just sits there. Is that normal? Is it root bound?
It's, and you've planted it out. How much sun does it get?
All day.
Okay. It probably, with the maples that you mentioned, it probably would be happier if it got sun in the morning, shade in the afternoon. It may be, since it's still a very small tree, worth transplanting. If you want a tree that will tolerate the sun much better, go to the big tooth maple. It's by far, it's really the only one that I recommend where you're looking for a large growing maple. So many of these others, you know, they came out, they supposedly had great promise, and most of them simply have turned out to be, you know, not any good at all in the full sun, and even in the shade, they haven't lived up to their billing, so to speak. So if you want a maple in the sun, probably go down. I think there are a couple of nurseries down in the Bandera area that are going to have the big tooth maples. You might find it at Friendly Natives right there in Fredericksburg. But the big tooth maple is the one that you want to plant up in that area. Your other one, I would probably, you know, do it today or do it sometime very soon. Get it out of that blazing sun. Get it into an area where it has decent soil, morning sun and afternoon shade, and I think it will live up to its potential. It's never going to be a real huge tree, never going to make a big full shade tree. It's just not that well adapted to our soils and our climate. But out in the sunny area, your big tooth maples, and that's the same one that grows over in the Lost Maple State Park, it should do very well for you in Fredericksburg.
Okay. And then I also planted a possum haw holly.
A great choice.
About 3 years ago, and it it's a slow growing. Is that normal too?
It is. They are slow growing. All hollies are relatively slow growing. And last summer, when most plants should have been just thriving and putting on growth, it was just so blasted hot that the plants were just hanging on trying to survive. So I'm not surprised with really, literally just about any plants when people tell me they didn't grow much in the past year. I'm just happy for things that survived the kind of summer we had last year. If we get back to a more typical hill country summer, your possum haw, in a good year, it can put on a foot of growth. It's not a fast-growing plant by any means, but it's a plant that can, you know, live for many, many years. And, of course, they're so beautiful with the red berries after they drop their foliage. So not surprised it didn't grow a lot. But especially if you got the variety called Warren Red, that's one of the best ever for the hill country. And long-term, I think it'll make an excellent plant for you.
Okay, Warren Red. And then I have a wildflower garden in the corner of my vegetable garden.
Uh-huh.
And the what I call wintergrass is taking over my little wildflower seedlings, you know, my bluebonnets, poppies, larkspur. Is there any way to control that wintergrass?
Yeah. What my grandmother called elbow grease. You know, they're giving us a pretty good chance of rain over the next couple of days. The good news is the wintergrass, rescue grass, whatever you want to call it, generally pulls up pretty easily if you're able to get it before it gets too big. The problem is, you know, and I was pulling this yesterday here at the nursery where it was coming up, you almost have to put your thumb on the ground so you don't pull up too much and damage your wildflower seedlings. But there's nothing safe to spray. Had we talked a month ago, I would have told you to get out and, you know, mow down your winter grass. About the only wildflowers that, you know, sprout really early are your bluebonnets. But many times in late fall, other than bluebonnets, you're able to spray the area with vinegar and orange oil, kill out the wintergrass as it tries to come up. But at this point, about all you can do is pull it where you can.
So if I wanted to control it, it needs to be sprayed early fall before the little seedlings, wildflower seedlings, come up.
As soon as the wintergrass germinates, as soon as it looks like a little grass, that's when you want to spray it, pull it, do whatever.
With the orange oil and vinegar.
Right.
Okay, one last question. I have a hen house with chickens.
Uh-huh.
And I clean it periodically, and I just take the manure and throw it on my flower beds.
Okay. And let me tell you a little bit more about that, but let me get Jimmy to put you on hold because we need to talk a little bit more. And I've got to go to news. We'll be right back here on KTSA Radio, San Antonio, Texas.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
All right. We'll grab one of those lines. Looks like James, Omar, and John are ahead of you, and we're going to talk to Marie just a little bit more first. But, Jimmy, I think she's on line number three. Let's get her back up for a minute. And we were talking about your hen house, and you were starting to tell me about what you do with the manure.
So every month or so, I just clean it out and throw the manure on my flower beds.
Uh-huh.
Somebody told me that needed to cure first before I use it for anything. Is that true?
Well, in most cases, if you're getting a large volume of it, it's what we would say is a little hot. It's a little strong. It can burn things. But my question to you, how is it working? How does your flower bed look?
They look great.
Then don't change the thing. Go right on what you're doing. And it obviously, you know, you're not generating cubic yards of this material. And, you know, if you decide you want more chickens and more eggs, yeah, it probably would be better to, in effect, compost it a little while, let it decompose a little bit. But if what you're doing is working, don't let anybody tell you to do something differently. As the old trite expression is, if it ain't broken, don't try to fix it.
And so, and I can throw that on a vegetable garden?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. In general, I would tell you don't put it right on the plants. Put it next to the plants. Put it on the surface of the ground. If you mulch your garden or add a little compost regularly, put your chicken manure down. I mean, most of the fertilizers you buy these days are if not chicken, they're at least poultry manure. So you're just getting it fresh from the plant, so to speak. And I wouldn't dump it right up against the stems of your plants. But if it works for your flowers, it's going to work for your vegetables. And there are no negatives to it. Just, you know, wash your root vegetables. You know, wash off those potatoes you'll probably be planting this week or whatever. But just keep on doing what you're doing. You're doing it right.
Thank you so much.
It is my pleasure. Thank you for the call this morning. I appreciate it. All right, let's move on with phone calls. And like I say, it's going to be James and Omar and John. And James is up first. Good morning, James.
Morning, Bob. How you doing?
Well, I'm off to a good start. How's Farmer James doing?
Well, I haven't got started yet, but hopefully it'll be a good start.
I'm sure it will be. It's a reasonable temperature out there, lots of moisture in the air, and your feet may get muddy, but I think it's going to be a pretty good day for gardening.
Yes, sir. I called with a question. I was asked to start some acorn squash.
Uh-huh.
And I wouldn't know acorn squash if it came up and bit me on the leg. I don't know anything about it.
Well, it's a long season squash, you know. I really don't like the term winter squash and summer squash, but technically it is what people call winter squash, but it certainly doesn't mean it grows in the winter. It just means that if you live up north where the people write the books, if you plant it in the spring, it's not ready until the next winter, because most of those winter squashes take minimum of 90 and sometimes 130, 140 days to produce. And acorn squash, I'd have to look at a seed package to tell you, but it seems to me like it's about 110-day squash. So, you know, it's probably good. Squash seedlings transplant pretty well, unlike, you know, root crops. So if you can get a little head start and have a little bit bigger plant to set out, you'll get your squash a little bit sooner. But whereas, as you well know, your zucchinis and your patty pans and your crooknecks, they're going to be producing in 45 days, and this stuff's going to take a lot longer. So plant it in a part of the garden that you don't have to disturb it, because it's going to be well into the summer before it even thinks about blooming and producing squash. But yeah, it's acorn squash is, you know, about like your Hubbard or your spaghetti squash, or it has a much tougher skin. It keeps much better. It's one of those squash you can store for an extended period of time. But Good choice, but it certainly grows differently than the old zucchini and crookneck that we all grow.
Do you have a recommended variety?
Not really. Just Hubbard is about the only name I know it by. I don't know that I've ever really seen. I'm not sure if your big seed companies will have it a lot, but if you go to Baker Creek or somewhere like that, you'll get a good variety. It's one of those squashes. I don't think they've really improved much over the years. The old varieties are still really good. And the good news is that, like most of your winter squashes, it has a very thin stem, and rarely does it have a problem with that squash vine borer, because the stem's so small, the borers can't really get inside of it very well.
There's a vining variety, and then there's a more of a bushing variety in the seed catalog.
I've never grown the bushing variety. The vining variety, I think, will give you more squash. It will take up a little bit more space in the garden, and it will occupy that space for a little longer, but not going to condemn something I haven't tried. The bush variety might be just fine. I'm just not familiar with one.
Okay, that gives me some good information to go forward with.
Start it just the same way you would your summer squash, but it's a different squash. Like I say, it's a real tough skin squash that stores for a long time. But as far as the growth, the only real difference is that it probably gets bigger than most of our summer squashes, and it certainly takes a lot longer to bloom and set fruit.
Okay, well, thanks for the information this morning, Bob. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's always a pleasure talking to you. Everything growing well for you? You getting those transplants going and getting ready to be real busy, I know.
Yeah, we do the squash, cucumbers, and vegetables that need to be transplanted next month. We start them in inch-and-a-half soil blocks, and then once they're germinated, they go into the 4-inch pots. So it's a lot of fun for the feeble-minded.
that's gardening in general. Let me get your take on something that a friend and customer that I had never really thought about it a lot. But when you've got your seed trays going, at what point do you start fertilizing them?
I usually push everything pretty hard with seaweed until they get up green and growing. And then I've switched over to Fox Farms Grow Big and push them in the vegetable.
If you want to try a little experiment, and I'm going by what a friend told me, but this guy's a great gardener, and above all, he keeps really good records. But he said that in researching it, he found that a tomato is one of the few plants that can really use nutrients from the day those cotyledons come out of the ground. And he said so many people, and he said he'd wait until the plants had their first true leaves before he'd hit them with the liquid fertilizer. And he said this past year, just as an experiment, he started hitting them with liquid fertilizer, you know, as soon as they emerged, literally, when they didn't have a true leaf, when there was nothing but seed leaves on them. And he said he got stockier, stronger, better plants than it ever had before. So I passed that along. Just like I say, I've had a chance to really research it. But he said there's research out there that says that tomatoes are the one vegetable that you really can and should start fertilizing earlier if you want a real stocky transplant. So if you have a chance, check that out and see what you think of it.
Yeah, I've got some liquid fertilizer, and I know how to use it, man. We're going to...
Well, try it a little earlier on your seedlings and see if you think it makes a difference. And, James, above all, have a great weekend, and I know we'll talk again soon.
Thanks, Bob.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Omar's next. Good morning, Omar.
Good morning, Bob. How you doing?
Off to a good start. Kind of a drizzly morning out there. I don't know that I'd be going for a long walk, but I don't have that option anyway. It's going to be a good day though. I love this weather where you don't have to wear that heavy coat and the wind just doesn't bite through you. So it's going to be a pretty good day to be out there.
Yeah, it should be. I'm running a little late. We're going to work some cattle on the New Athens River right outside of George West, so hopefully the weather will hold up and let us get done.
Well, that's you got your work cut out for you. I was talking to a fella who had some of their cattle decided to visit some of my cattle recently, and it was a bit of an effort, but as I told him, you can't make a cow do anything. You got to let them think it's their idea, and it's a great tradition. I have a very good friend that participates in the longest continuously operated cattle drive up the Green River in Wyoming every year. They run several thousand head up about 100-125 miles of river. So
wow.
It's a great Western tradition that today's kids wouldn't even know what you were talking about with the cattle drive. So you get out and get your cows done, and then what are you going to do that I can advise you on?
I was late on trimming my asparagus back in the wintertime or early fall, and I finally did. I cut it, and in about 4 days, it shot up foot and a half.
Right.
So am I to let that continue throughout the summer?
No. It when you start letting it get big, it stops making many new shoots. Now, if it's a foot and a half tall, you can probably, you know, snap the upper 6 inches of it off and get something that you can eat. But with asparagus, when you harvest everything that comes up. And when you stop harvesting, you completely stop harvesting. So if this is a bed that's been there for a while, I hate to tell you, again, you need to cut it back again. You can probably use the tops, but then start watching it real carefully, because every day you're going to have some sprout up, and it needs to be harvested by the second day after it comes out of the ground.
Okay, now this is some seed that I started last spring.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So it's the diameter is very, very small on this thing.
Well, then in that case, if these are young plants, yeah, just don't do anything. You know, we usually wait till the second or third year before we start harvesting at all. So at this point, fertilize, let it grow up, let it make the ferns. The bigger and stronger the plants get this year, the longer you can harvest from them next year. So, if these are new plants, then water it, fertilize it, encourage it to get as big as it possibly can.
Okay, so I'm not trimming until Thanksgiving or something like that.
Not till this time next year. Probably around New Year's Day is a good day to do it.
Gotcha. And last weekend I heard y'all talking about a particular variety of jalapeno, jalafuego, and we've grown it several years, and it's a good little pepper. It produces a bunch of them on a deep plant. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, I'm always looking for something new, and that was a new one to me, so I'm glad that I'm talking to somebody that knows something about it. That's good information, and I appreciate it.
And I'm trying the Jedi. I heard y'all talking about that one, and me being a Star Wars fan, I said, well, I've got to do that one. There's no way not to.
Yep, and as long as we don't get that Death Star summer, then it should do well for you. Have you grown shishitos? Have you tried those things yet?
I have, yeah. We've grown them on and off here and there. The first year was an experiment or quarter disaster, because they were too close to my serranos, and about every fifth pepper, we were, you know, fixing to dial 911, because they were just stupid hot. but it wasn't every one of them, you know, it was just every few. So the next year I got them away from it, and again, that's another one that just produces an enormous amount of peppers.
On a small plant, and if you do like my friends up at the Dodging Duck do, they blister them in an iron skillet and serve them with a ranch dressing, or they actually make something they call the cilantro lime dressing. And that's one of those things you can eat a lot of without suffering, you know, when you get the growing down. And I tell people, because everybody wants to be successful, and if you want to grow peppers and you can't be successful with shishitos, we're going to have a talk, because that's one of the easiest and most productive little peppers I've ever grown.
They really are. Well, all right, sir, that's all I had.
Well, Omar, you get out and be safe out there, and get those cows moving, and we'll talk again soon.
All righty, we'll see you.
All right, sir, thank you. John, hang on just a second. You're up next, but it looks like I get to talk to you for just a minute about my good friends at Wild Birds Unlimited, and I always enjoy talking about Kyle and his staff because simply they love wildlife. They love nature. They know birds better than anything, but they can answer an awful lot of your questions about your backyard wildlife, so to speak. And they will tell you the scouts are here. Scouts are already arriving for the purple martins. And if this is a year you wanted to attract purple martins to your landscape, you better get those houses up real soon, and they can certainly help you. You want to play that dawn song tape. You want to get those martins coming in, and they call them scouts, but they're actually just young unmated pairs are always the first ones to show up. But, you know, what I'm telling you is if you want purple martins and you don't have your houses up, you better get to Wild Birds Unlimited today. Of course, they've got the great things, the baffles to put on the birdhouse poles. They've got all kinds of nesting boxes, and they've got all kinds of, you know, good food, so to speak. They know that birds eat different things in the winter than they do in the summer, and that's why they have a winter seed blend, plus all the different kinds of suet cake that will benefit your birds. Don't go to the grocery store. They're going to try to sell you the same low quality year-round. Wild Birds Unlimited always deals in top quality with the appropriate things for the season. Got a lot of related accessories, too. I bought some deflectors to keep the rain off of some of the suet blocks and some of the cake materials we put out. They've got the best in feeders, most of which come with a lifetime warranty. And again, they can answer all your questions. They've been doing this for a lot of years. They'll help you bring in the birds you want and exclude the ones you don't. But it's more than just birding. They've got a great selection of gift merchandise. They've got a lot of ways to offer water to your birds. It's just always fun to visit Wild Birds Unlimited. The store I'm talking about is out in the shopping center at the corner of Northwest Military and Huebner, kind of on the side that faces Northwest Military. You're going to look at it from a distance and say, well, that's not a very big place. You're going to walk through the door and say, wow, it's a really neat place staffed by really nice people with really top quality products. Wild Birds Unlimited.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening. Looks like it's going to be John and Shirley and Kimberly and Judy. John's first in line. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
I had Edder Tree Service come out and do some air spading for me.
Uh-huh.
And just right off the bat, I just want to say really, really good people. Michael come out, went through the project deal with me, told me what I could do to help save me money. You know, they could do it, but if I did it, I could save money. I mean, very, very thorough and super, super nice people.
That's why they're the only tree service I recommend for anything complex. And it's funny you say that. We had them out doing some air spading for us about 6 weeks ago. So, yeah, they're good people. I'm glad you had a good experience with them. The only thing wrong is you sometimes have to wait a while to get them because they are busy. There's some other folks I recommend if you just need a tree removed. But boy, when it comes to arborist, it is sure the best.
Yeah, I've got a lot of problems with these trees. When they planted the trees, they didn't remove any of the lifting bands or anything like that, and just put them a little deeper and throw dirt over them so it didn't know. And I mean, there's, you know, it had an air spade just to get down where we could get the bands cut off, the water cage left on it. It's a mess. But,
well, I'm glad you realized the problem before it killed your trees. That's the good news, and I'm glad you're correcting it.
Yeah, I think I may have been too late on some of them. But anyway, my question is, because, like I say, some of these the flares are like 12 inches deep.
Mm-hmm.
They were telling me to go ahead and leave the surrounding ground around them for about a year.
Uh-huh.
And take it all away. So what I'm wondering, Bob, is when I fertilize, do I fertilize down around the flares?
No. That's a great question. But trees tend to absorb the majority of their water pretty close to the trunk, pretty close to the flare, certainly within 10 feet or so of the tree itself. But they absorb most of their nutrient a lot further out than that through the little fine hair roots and probably more out toward the drip line. So I would not do any fertilizing probably within 5 to 10 feet of the trunk, except on a very young tree. That's a different story. But on your mature trees, no, you ought to be out practically to the drip line and then a few feet on either side of that to apply your fertilizer.
Okay. They're more like in a natural setting rather than, you know, yard. Well, I got some in the
yard.
But,
yeah.
So I guess that's what I was worried about. And I guess I've maybe over the last couple of 3 years that they've been in the ground been maybe doing it a little too close. So,
well, it hasn't hurt anything, but it hasn't benefited the trees as much either. Recognize that the important thing is having air circulation around the root flare and, you know, up the trunk from that point. Unfortunately, you really shouldn't pile anything around the trees. You know, keep that soil pull back. Ultimately, you may want to, you know, kind of just make a big kind of a saucer-shaped indentation that slopes down gradually to the root flare on all sides. You're probably going to take out a few little fibrous roots when you do that, but that's not going to hurt a thing. If you say, I can't really do that, then you're going to have to build a little silo, you know, around the trunk and give them a few inches of air space, because that trunk's going to grow and eventually fill it up. But only important thing is having air circulation around the trunk from the root flare up. And you don't necessarily have to do a huge excavation to do that, whether you're using an air spade or a shovel.
Yeah. Okay, well, I think that's got me taken care of on that, Dan. I went ahead and had them do it around, like, some American holly and the cherry laurels and stuff.
Yeah.
I'm trying to ask is, does every tree, for the most part, have a root flare?
Every woody plant, shrub or tree, usually will have the equivalent of a root flare. A palm tree does not. A cycad does not. But they're in a whole different class of plants. They're monocots rather than dicots. Their stem is totally structured differently. They can actually be buried. We dug up a palm tree or tried to dig up a palm tree, eventually succeeded, down along the Guadalupe one time on my partner's property. And we had to go down through about 3 feet of alluvial fill before we even found the roots on that. So any woody plant, whether it's a holly, a pittosporum, photinia, whatever, they have a root flare. It won't be as pronounced necessarily as it will in a shade tree, but every woody shrub is the same. Their structure of the stem above and below the ground level is different, and that root flare needs to be exposed, whether it's a boxwood, a holly, or a live oak.
And also, because of these bands that were on there, and they were all neoprene and pulled very tight onto the
boots,
I got a lot of girdling.
Mm-hmm.
So, do you need to put paint on all of them? Like I said, I've got numerous different kinds of the Chinese pistache, live oaks, all kinds of stuff.
Well, you don't. The only ones you need to seal the wounds on are red oaks and live oaks. You need to get those bands out as much as possible. But red oaks and live oaks are the only ones that are going to be badly impacted by oak wilt. And it doesn't have to be pruning paint. It can be anything that seals up that wound for 10 days or so. Beyond that point, it's healed to where they would not be infectable, so to speak. So don't even give it a thought on your photinias and things like that. But red oaks and live oaks, yeah, if that wound is going to be above ground and exposed, just common old, spray paint is just fine. Just anything that seals that wound over for 10 days so the beetles can't get to it.
Okay. Bob, I appreciate it, and you have a great day. And, again, if anybody wonders about it, there's no wonder about it.
Well, just remember, if you need them, plant a couple of months in advance because it'll take them a while to get to you. But I'm so glad you had a good experience. I certainly have with them as well. So appreciate it, John. And Shirley, hang on just a second. You will be next in line, followed by Kimberly and Jody. I get to take a break here for just a minute and talk to you about my friends over at Fanix. And that's always such a pleasure. Mark and Mike, and they've got the fourth generation of the Fanix family working in the nursery now. And Fanix is certainly our oldest nursery here in San Antonio, celebrating 85 years over there, same location over on Home Green Road, just a couple of blocks off South W.W. White. And lots of things going on over there. They're having a 30% off sale on all their house plants, and that goes all the way through February. On their tomatoes, they've now got 40 varieties of tomatoes and 15 varieties of peppers. They've got all kinds of other things, citrus and berries and grapes. And by the way, they've got a new shipment of the Ego lithium-ion battery-powered outdoor equipment. It's just amazing, all the things that you'll find over at Fanix. They also have the Traeger pellet grills and all the accessories there. All the winter vegetables you're looking for, and getting those summer ones going too. Plus, they have all the organic fertilizers and compost and other things like that that you may need. If you want to check out all their upcoming events and sales and things they have planned to celebrate 85 years in business, go to their website, Fanick, F-A-N-I-C-K, FanickNursery.com. Go see them. They're open 7 days a week, only closed on major holidays.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 1071.
All right, let's get back to gardening and back to the phone line. Shirley's next in line. Good morning, Shirley.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
Another tree questions. I have Monterey oaks. I have Montezuma cypress and pecans. I have the roots are all exposed, and around them is dirt. Black dirt. Can I cover that up with river rock to keep the mud? My dog chases squirrels when it's wet. Just and brings the mud in the house. Can I put river rock around that?
You don't want to put it against the trunk, but out over the roots, it's just fine. Just don't put any of these fabrics or plastic or anything underneath it. They don't work, and they're real hard on the trees because they don't allow any oxygen through there, and they hold too much water underneath. So, yeah, river rock's fine, but no so-called weed block.
And I don't have to put mulch underneath the river rock?
No reason to. Trees might like it, but it's not mandatory.
My son thinks it'll make it too hot, but it won't. Okay, so that was great.
No, not at all.
All right, now I need some shrubs that are about up to 10 feet tall that are tougher than the ones I had with the cold, and evergreen. Do you have a list that I can get from you?
We don't really have a list, but I can tell you what several good ones are. That probably would be a good thing for us to make a list sometime. There's several large hollies. There's Nellie Stevens. There's Foster's Holly. These are large-leaved hollies. Standard Burford will get up to 10 feet. Dwarf Burford only goes about 5. But there are several evergreen hollies in that group that have beautiful red berries through the winter months, cold hardy down to probably 10 below zero. The only disadvantages are a little slower growing, but they're certainly cold hardy, excellent plants. Small-leaved hollies, standard Yaupon holly, can be trimmed to be a small tree or can be trimmed to be a big shrub, and it is very cold hardy. Japanese yew, not to be confused with the poisonous northern yew, the Japanese yew or Podocarpus, is not a toxic plant, and it grows to that size easily. Those are probably the most cold hardy shrubs. Now, mountain laurel certainly grows to 10 feet, and it's evergreen, and it's very cold hardy. So even though I wouldn't call it a shrub, it's a bushy tree, so to speak. And so that should very definitely be on the list. If you can find the old-fashioned, what we call Chinese photinia, not the red tips. Those things are worthless. But the old-fashioned Chinese photinia blooms with pretty white flowers, very cold hardy and very disease resistant. So I'd make that another potential choice.
Okay, that sounds good. Another question. Can I still plant my beets?
getting a little late, but if you think it's going to be a while before summer's heat gets here, yes, absolutely. Are you growing them for the beet or for the greens or for both?
Well, mostly the beets. I love it. And I have old-fashioned red beets.
Detroit dark red, still a variety that is, I don't think it's ever been improved on in the last 100 years. So, yeah, but I would get it done soon. I mean, we're just finishing the first week of February. Beets are about a 50-day crop, so you still have plenty of time to harvest some beets before it's too hot.
And onions, I can do that now?
Absolutely. Okay. I do them from plants rather than seed. People mistakenly call them sets, but sets are a little bulb that was interrupted in growth, and I've never had any luck with them here. But those little onion plants you buy in a bunch of 70 to 100 plants, yeah, plant them this afternoon.
And do you have them?
We do.
Good. Okay, it sounds
great. Most of your good nurseries will. I know Fannix and Rainbow do as well, but if you come in our direction, we'd love to see you.
Oh, yes, I'm certainly doing that. Thank you, Bob. Have a good day.
You do the same, Shirley. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Let's go ahead and talk to Kimberly. Good morning, Kimberly.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, then. I want to talk to you about Texas purple thistle. I am overrun with it this year.
Yeah, it's...
How do I get rid of it? I mean, I hoe, and as soon as I see them, mm-hmm. I start. I walk around with a hoe. And I tend to do about an hour of work, and usually an hour maybe every couple of weeks, and I have it done. This year, I could do it every day.
Well, and you're probably going to have to do it every day for a while. One plant, they say, can make up to 500,000 seed. And apparently the weather was just right because I was out weed eating around some of my yard or line trimmer using. I've never seen as many of them coming up. The secret is whatever you're doing, and I trust you're using a grubbing hoe rather than a garden hoe, but if you can chop
right.
down and get them an inch below the surface, they won't come back. But this was just the year that, you know, some years they're very cyclical, and some years for whatever reason not much of the seed sprouts, but it must have been an awfully good year from the thistle's point of view, because like you, I've never seen so many of them come up, and I don't know a better way. And you just have to think of it as exercise instead of work. But
that's what I do.
Yeah.
But yesterday I was out there and I was wondering. Okay, I start getting crazy. I wanted to go and buy a flamethrower and start burning them away.
Well, but then probably if you did that, they'd just come back out. But again, if it's an area that you mow, if you mow them off 4 or 5 times, they will die. So nothing says you have to, you know, chop them individually, but my problem is in the areas that I rely on mowing, then somehow life, as Dave Ramsey says, life happens, and I miss a week, and then all of a sudden I've got them up with flowers on them. And once they have the flowers, the seed is practically mature by the time the flower opens, and then you're just having, you know, putting off your problems till next year. So keep on what you're doing, and you'll have the healthiest upper body musculature of anybody you know.
Okay, well, thank you. I was hoping there was something magic I could do, but I guess not.
the magic is in having kids that you know, still believe in hard work and somebody that you can get to help you. But there's no magic bullet that you can go out there. If you get them really young, you can kill them with vinegar and orange oil, but with it warming up, our permanent grasses are starting to come back, and the thistles are, I don't, you know, that big one, at least you can chop it and get rid of it. The one I really hate is this little Malta star thistle that we're starting to see more of around. In the future, if it's in a lawn area, putting on some compost in the fall really works as a pre-emergent herbicide. It keeps a lot of those seeds from germinating, but this late in the season, most of the seed has already germinated, so it's too late. But if you can, October, November, if you can get half an inch of compost out over these areas where they're a problem, you'll have very few to deal with next year.
Oh, I have a problem that I have acreage, so
yeah.
There's no way.
You and me both.
My house, I tried to get them. And I tried to leave some of them for the birds and the butterflies, but this year I think I'm going to hate them.
No, you get every one of them. Believe me, there are going to be plenty of them on the neighbor's place for the birds and butterflies. And you put out those good Wild Birds Unlimited feeders and seed and things like that, and put out a butterfly feeder or two. Yeah, you can attract them in without leaving the thistles. So get out there and get after them.
Okay, then. Thank you very much.
You are certainly welcome. Let me see here. What time? Let's get our last break of the hour in here, and then Judy and Anna will be up next. Jimmy, I don't have a live, so run those recordings, and we'll get back to phone calls.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening and back to the phone lines. Going to be Judy and then Anna. Good morning, Judy.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
Okay. My backyard used to be nice, thick, kind of thick, St. Augustine. Mm-hmm. And then about 5 years ago, I put compost on it, and it started getting a little bit of the oxalis. Okay. And then we came into the freeze and the two hot summers, and it's just completely taken over. And someone has recommended that I put corn gluten meal on it, but I'm thinking it's too late now.
Yeah, you're thinking right. Well, I guess if there's any good about oxalis, it is actually a soil builder. Oxalis, the clovers, are legumes, and they can grow and flourish in soil that has gotten very hard. And, unless you're putting some compost down with some regularity, and then it doesn't help when we have these blistering summers and really cold winters. The soil does get compacted, and this is why your oxalis is thriving and your grass is a little slow to come out. I would fertilize. I would, if it's in the budget, put a little more compost down, and we're just not warm enough for your regular. Do you have St. Augustine, Bermuda? What's your permanent grass?
It's St. Augustine, but, yep. I walked it yesterday, and I'm just afraid there's not much. It's like really, because I had the guy come in, because I've got like all these oak trees, so I had mm-hmm. him blow all the oak leaves to yep. kind of keep ahead, and so I could really see the ground,
okay.
And I'm just really disgusted with it.
The St. Augustine you have, is it green now or is it still brown from the winter?
It's a little, I saw some green, but there's not a whole lot there. The strings, the
runners?
Yeah, the runners. I saw the runners, and they look dead. They're brown. Because I thought, maybe I'll go out there and spray it with orange oil.
Well, and that the vinegar orange oil mix would be, that's what I was getting around to. If your St. Augustine is missing or if it is still browned out from the winter, it won't hurt to spray it with vinegar and orange oil, and you'll kill the oxalis with that. Long term, good St. Augustine will choke out the oxalis, but oxalis starts growing a lot earlier in the spring. I can't tell you how many hundreds of little plants I've pulled up around the nursery in various places. But at this point, if you do it soon, vinegar and orange oil will kill back the oxalis without hurting your grass. Do fertilize, and let's see how your St. Augustine comes back. But if you can do a little compost and most definitely do some fertilizer to support the St. Augustine, do so. And vinegar and orange oil will kill the oxalis back and hopefully give your St. Augustine a chance to get started. Once it's up and growing well, it will choke out the oxalis. But remember, the oxalis is improving your soil, so it's not all bad, but there is such a thing as too much oxalis.
There's just too much now. I mean, it's not like a little spot that I used to have. It's just like I took a picture yesterday. It's just taken over. And So, well, okay, well, I'll try the vinegar and orange oil and bring in some more compost. That just scares me. That's what brought the weeds into the yard in the first place.
Well, it actually, what it did was soften the soil and just make it a better place for the weeds to grow. Compost, by its very nature, the weed seed don't survive in compost. So it just created too good a situation when your grass was weak and all the other seeds said, oh my, this is wonderful. Let's grow here. But the reason you've got the oxalis is your ground was getting hard. Hopefully it's done its job so you can get rid of the oxalis, but you will have softer soil, and that will help your permanent grass come back and do better.
Yeah, one other question, because, you know, again, people talk about going through and I don't even know what they call it, where they...
Aerifying?
Yeah. What'd you say?
It's aerifying or aerating.
Yeah. And that doesn't make sense to me for... St. Augustine.
No, it doesn't, and most of them use the wrong kind of aerifier anyway, but you're right, it's not a good thing for St. Augustine. Do it naturally, maybe put out a little bit of garret juice, put out some more compost when you can. Those things naturally aerify the yard rather than something that's going to break up your sprinkler system and not do much good anyway.
Yeah, okay. All right, well, listen, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Get out and have a good weekend, and let's talk to Anna. Good morning, Anna.
Hey, hi, Bob. Greetings from Ohio.
I was going to say, you're a long way north of us, but very good morning to you. What's going on today?
Yeah, well, got some work to do with some raised beds, and that's the big project. We've got some treated lumber beds that have lasted 15 years.
That's good. That's longer than most of it lasts these days.
Yeah, it's time to replace them. So we're thinking, what are your suggestions on, you know, maybe some cedar or some other material? What do you think would be a good
thing? I want you to probably go online and see if you can find Eco Vantage. Now, I know they're changing the name. I just learned this week they're going to change the name, and I can't remember what the new name's going to be. But I want you to look for Eco, E-C-O, Eco Vantage Wood.
Mm-hmm.
If you come back to this part of the country to visit, we built one greenhouse, several decks, and several arbors with it. It is not a special kind of wood. It's a specially treated kind of wood, but it's not treated chemically. It is super, super kill dried. It's dried to the point it bakes carbohydrates out of it, so termites don't like it. When you feel the wood, it feels very smooth. It's actually sealed the surface of the wood to where water can't get in. Even when you cut it, screw it, drill it, do all the things we do with it as carpenters. They've had it in ground contact in East Texas for 30 years, no rotting. Pilings in swamps for 30 years, no rotting. I'm estimating it's probably going to last 50 years.
Wow.
And it's a process. It's not a kind of wood. What we're using, and it's again, I wish you could see all the things that we have built with it, but we use pine. It's been treated. I have looked at, back when I first got introduced to it, they also treat fir. They also treat different kinds of wood, but it's a good old number two yellow pine with this heat treatment. And it's not anything new. This was invented in Finland all the way back in 1939. It's a little pricey. It's a little bit more than treated wood, but it is so much better quality. And from a carpenter's point of view, it is just a joy to work with.
Wow. You know, it makes me think of this spray that we had done on our deck about 5 years ago that's supposed to be something that seals the wood completely, mm-hmm. about 6 inches deep and mm-hmm. prevents all of the things that you're talking about. And I wonder if it's a... You're talking about a finished product, and ours was a spray-on product that the company...
Well, and the problem with the spray-on is you can't get it on the bottom of the deck. But see if you can find it. I know the plant where they do this, I don't say manufacture, but the plant where they produce it is somewhere up in the Midwest. I don't know if it's in Ohio, but it's much closer to you than it is to us. So you're probably going to get an even better price on it than we do. But check with your bigger lumber yards. You're not going to find it at Handy Dan or whoever your lumber company still is. I realize it's Home Depot or Lowe's across the country now. But if you've got a real lumber yard, research it or go to the EcoVantage website and perhaps you'll find a number you can call there and they can tell you who the nearest distributor will be. Here they don't really have retail outlets. They're just not set up for drop-in customers, but if you're building a deck, if you're building a fence, things like that, they're happy to work with you. But check it out. I think it would be it's the only thing I'll build out of these days. And we're probably going to actually build some raised beds sometime soon. And that's exactly what they're going to be built of.
Okay. Sounds good. I got another couple of things.
You've got about a minute and a half.
I've got what is called a magnolia tulip bush.
Yeah. It's about a deciduous magnolia. Magnolia solangiana. Yep.
Okay. Does that need, can we trim that? Because it's about 15 by 15 and encroaching everything.
Let it bloom in the spring first and then trim it. If you trim now, you lose all your spring bloom.
Yeah, because it's got a lot of buds on it now.
Yeah, okay. Treat it like a climbing rose. Let it bloom first and then trim.
Okay, sounds good. And we'll probably be down sometime next year or this year later and stop in and look at your carpentry work.
Oh, you'll have a lot to see.
All righty, awesome. Thank you much, Bob.
Well, it's always a pleasure talking to you. You get out and enjoy this wonderful weekend. And only got about 30 seconds till news time. And, of course, we'll be visiting with Howard Garrett right after the news. Save the last 30 minutes or so of the program for a few more calls. So if you didn't get your question in the first 2.5 hours, we'll have a little bit more for you later. And then, of course, we do gardening from 8 until 11 tomorrow. Anna is an old friend who lived in San Antonio, so I know her so well. But anyway, I appreciate you joining me this morning. Stick around. It's always a pleasure visiting with you. You're listening to KTSA Radio in beautiful San Antonio, Texas.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now, 210-599-5555.
Oh, but don't call right this minute because we're getting ready for our visit with the dirt doctor, Mr. Howard Garrett. We'll save approximately the last 30 minutes of the show for more questions. And then, of course, we do this again tomorrow morning from 8 o'clock until 11, at which time Dr. Kirby comes in and we get to talk about your pet's health. But right now, it's time for the dirt doctor. Good morning, Howard.
Well, it's raining here again. I got a question for you, though.
I just looked at the radar and saw that good rain. So, what's the question?
Are we through with the freezes?
Unless it gets to 32. You know, I worked, one of my wonderful mentors was Alton Grimm down here, and people would come in and say, "Alton, when's it going to freeze?" And he'd look at him and say, "When it gets to 32." So, I don't know.
That's a good answer both ways. I tell you, it's been very, very gentle. I hadn't even had to worry about shutting the greenhouse. I've been leaving the vents open at night, not turning on the heater. I'm a little cavalier about it. I probably let it get a little too cool in there. But it's been very, very nice, and there's nothing in the forecast. Of course, like you say, never know until it happens.
I was looking, and in fact, I was just looking at forecasts for Dallas, and it looks like you're going to be down in the 30s a few nights this week. And as I always tell people, you can get frost even at 36 or 37, and frost can do a number on tomatoes and peppers and really tender plants. But I don't know. I sure want to believe we've had enough winter, and I'd love to believe that the really bad stuff is behind us, but we'll see. If it gets to 32, it's going to freeze.
Yeah, I noticed close to 40, some frost around my house, especially more on the roof of the house than anywhere, which is kind of interesting.
It's, as they say, exposed surfaces, and the meteorologist tried to explain the phenomenon of frost to me, and I still don't fully understand how water can freeze, which is what frost is, when you know, when it's 38 or 39 degrees. Doesn't have to get to 32 to have frost, but I guess my mind's not quite strong enough to wrap around that concept. But if you figure it out, let me know. I just know that frost can occur even, like you say, when it's up close to 40 degrees. And on your roof, it's not a problem, but on your tomato plants, it's a big problem.
Yeah, it is. No, I hadn't figured it out really either, other than it has to get colder right at the surface. And I think there's some kind of chemistry activity that happens between the warmth of the surface and the coolness of the air. But like you say, it's kind of like me understanding hard math.
Or physics. I got along okay in math, but physics left me behind something terrible. But and it's interesting, too, and something else that I don't know if you've observed, but I've had people that thought they were going to protect plants just turning a nursery can or a bucket or something over them. And underneath just a plain, you know, cover like that, I've had things freeze worse than they did out in the open, and it's why I don't recommend it. I recommend the row covers as exclusively the way to give some protection, and you would think that put that cover over it and it'd stay a little warmer. I guess it does help keep the frost off, but it's amazing how much stuff will freeze when you just turn something over it.
Well, I may have just lucked out, but I've done the exact same thing in the past before the freeze miser came around.
Uh-huh.
I would put trash cans over faucets and hose bibs,
where
I could do that,
out
in the garden, and I've never had any freeze damage. And I assumed I was doing some good, but like you say, I used that green opaque tarp covering on some plants before, and I've had other listeners tell me the same thing. It didn't seem to protect the plants a bit. Now, what the difference is between a container and that tarp, I have no idea.
And you complicate it even further, because I've had the same experience. That protects the pipes, you know, pretty well. But I don't know, something about living things. But just hopefully we won't have to worry about it for very much longer this year.
Well, it may surprise us. I didn't like having that really cold temperature. I thought we were going to get through the entire season this year and have a mild winter, but that didn't happen. But maybe it'll shut off early and we'll have a nice long spring.
Well, everybody always says when we have a late Easter, we have late cold, and Easter is very, very early this year, so I'm very much in hopes that the reverse happens, that when you have an early Easter, the cold will move out early. But a month from now, when we're talking about it, we'll have a little better idea of it.
Yep, we'll see. Nothing we can do about it.
That's exactly right, except cover the plants up. Had an interesting thing that I wanted to run by you. One of our listeners and one of our customers here at the nursery, and this guy took our advice a while back, and he keeps really, really good records of pretty much everything he does. And he said that he had done some research, and I don't know where this was, where he found the information, but he said that tomatoes are one of the few plants that benefit from fertilizing with Garrett juice, with Has to Grow, with whatever, as soon as the seedling plant gets above the ground. He said so many people advising say, oh, you don't want to start fertilizing until the tomato puts on its first true leaves. But this past year, he started just as soon as it came up, as soon as little cotyledons were up. And we saw the plants. They were the strongest, stockiest, and this is in seed trays. And, by the time they started producing their second or third set of true leaves and were ready to go into individual pots, they were weeks ahead of what he had grown in the previous couple of years. So, and he said this year he's going to do a control as well, one batch that he doesn't start fertilizing until they have true leaves, and the other he's going to do like he did this past year and start fertilizing as soon as they sprouted. And I pass it along for what it's worth. It might be an interesting experiment to do for people that still start their transplantable things like tomatoes and peppers from seed.
Well, that makes sense, and the thought about avoiding that probably came up from people using the harsh chemical
yep.
fertilizers.
Yep.
I think that organic fertilizers in general will help you with that, and when you use the liquid things, and I think Garrett juice might I've done that myself. I've used it on new transplants the day they go in, drenching real heavy, pouring it over the top of the plant, so mm-hmm. you get some foliar feeding as well as feeding of the soil. So that makes sense. I'll try that myself.
Yeah.
I'm about to plant some things and run some experiments myself, and I'll take a look at that as well.
Well, it'd be interesting just, you know, just starting it a little bit earlier, because I'm like you. I've always waited until the plants were fair-sized before I really got in. Of course, I'd put down dry fertilizer a month ahead when I get around to it, but I'd try to put down dry fertilizer with a little compost over the top of it, you know, 4 to 6 weeks in advance of the time I'm going to start planting. And I feel like that must do some good, because when I go to dig for tomatoes or pepper transplants, man, there are a lot of earthworms down there. I really think it helps to do that a little bit in advance, and then follow up with the liquids after things are up and growing.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's right. I don't do it as much as I should, because I'm just too lazy and or too busy.
Yeah, I like the busy. Oh, so what all's in your garden at this point?
Oh, I'm just still messing around with the cool season stuff. I've got beets coming on. The Swiss chard's looking really good. The kale is doing well. A lot of the stuff bit the dust, though, from just putting one layer of the floating row cover on it. It cooked the cauliflower, and I do have some broccoli still coming on, and I'm planting a new round of some of those transplants here right away. It's just having time to do it. I was planning on doing it today. We had heavy rain last night, so
yeah.
I don't know if I'm going to be messing in the soil with it sopping wet today or not.
Well, if you're in the soil today, you're going to be messing, and your forecast says you've still got 100% chance of rain today, and we could use a little more. I know y'all are pretty wet, and we've had better rains than we have for a couple of years, but and my lake is full, I'm happy to say. I walked up and looked at it yesterday, but the aquifer's down here, and, of course, you've got surface water, we've got groundwater. But, man, we still need some more water for the rivers and for our aquifers and things like that. So once you get saturated, just send it down our way, and we'll put it to good use.
All right, I'll try to. We've got a lot of things that have swollen buds, and we have a lot of things that have already leafed out. My Mahonia bilii is in full yellow bloom. It's a lot of plants thinking it's spring for sure. Buckeyes, which come out really early, are about halfway leafed out now, so it's kind of an interesting time to watch your plants. I have, as you know, about four different kinds of buckeyes, and sometimes mm-hmm. the Ohio buckeye is real slow to come out, but this year it's leading the way. It's the one that's the farthest along. It's really interesting.
I don't know. Just when you think you've got it figured out, who knows? It and fruit trees, we're starting to see. I'm not seeing yep. any open flowers, but I'm seeing lots of swelling buds. And
big buds. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was actually a pretty good year for fruit trees, even if we hadn't gotten. That's one thing I find myself explaining to people all the time. You know, 15 degrees is no better than 43 degrees. The chilling hour is below 45, and having the severe cold, people tell me, oh, well, it gets the insects. I don't think that's true, but we had a lot of that weather that we were hoping would continue, where it was down below the chilling point but not really severely cold. So I suspect it's going to be a pretty good year for peaches and plums if we don't get a late freeze.
I do, too. I think so. One of the things I might want to throw out, the organic fruit and pecan tree program that we have on dirtdoctor.com. If people hadn't looked at it, you might want to take a look. One of the big differences that I recommend, one of the big changes I recommend over the chemical deal, is that the first spraying you do is at pink bud, which is
uh-huh.
now. And you don't spray anything that kills. You spray garlic, pepper, tea. You spray repellent type things. Garret juice mixed with garlic, pepper, tea is becoming my favorite thing to do. The only negative about that is you got to make the garlic, pepper, tea yourself.
And what is your formula? Yeah, what is your formula on the garlic pepper tea?
Well, the base formula, and it can vary like everything I've come up with, but the base formula is two bulbs, the whole bulb, not just a clove, two bulbs of garlic and two hot peppers, hotter the better, habanero, ghost pepper, whatever you can. Throw them in a blender and enough water just to blend up and make a nice slurry. Mix and then screen out the solids. Keep the solids. You can use them in bed preparation and whatnot. But that liquid that you get, add enough water to it to make it a gallon. And then use a cup to 2 cups of that gallon per of your concentrate per gallon of water for the spray.
I'm writing as fast as I can write, but that's probably on dirtdoctor.com, isn't it?
Yeah, the easy way to find all my formulas and all my recommended programs like the fruit and pecan tree program is to go to the homepage of dirtdoctor.com and click on guides. It's in capital letters. And under guides, that's where all the basic stuff is, including how to make garret juice, the sick tree treatment, the tree trunk goop, including the new formula that I recommend so much and all that.
You know, that reminds me, I need to get on there and actually print out a bunch of those things to give to our customers.
Sure. Be fine anytime.
And we always give credit where credit is due. And golly, y'all have so many good things up there now. And it's everybody can do things a little bit better, and it's just knowing what to do. And, you know, not a day goes by that I haven't recommended DirtDoctor.com to 10 to 50 people because there is so much good information there.
One of the things you might want to check every day is that top right-hand corner, because that's where anything that's new that's going on the website or any edits or additions, changes, whatever shows up there. And we keep some of the things that we want people to not miss there all the time, like the fabulous tree slideshow.
Right, right. Well, backing up just a little bit, I'm getting more questions these days about beets, and I know you grow good beets in your garden. Do you have any special tricks or thoughts to so many people, and I think at least part of it is not thinning enough, but an awful lot of people say, well, gee, I can go grow good greens, but I don't get a very big beet on the bottom. What's your secret?
Yeah, I think the thinning is important, and thinning out also, you can use that young foliage when you thin to go in salads or cook it by itself. I mean, it's delicious and very, very tender at that point. I think the treatment with the garret juice before you plant the seed is pretty amazing. This year I had as good or better results with my beets than ever before, and I did a little bit different garret juice treatment. I sprayed the seed on paper. You know, really.
Right.
What I use is a quart hand spritz bottle, you know, and spritz them really good, really get them soaked, and then let them dry completely so they don't stick to your hand. You can just spread them better that way. And then after they're in the soil, gently work them into the soil just a little bit, and then drench the whole bed with the garret juice. That's the first time I had done it that way, and really looks like it's the best results I've had. They're still coming on and producing right now, and we eat beets a lot. Yep. Even though somebody was telling me the other day, I had a guest on my show talking about human health, and they were talking about not eating staying away from sugar, and they were talking about even some of the vegetables that are high in carbohydrates, you know, beets and carrots, you know, among the two most important. And I'm not going to stay away from those. I don't think most people are, but it is something that's a fact.
Well,
my dogs love beets more than Judy and I do, I think.
Well, and look at the good things that are so many of your blood pressure medicines, the Neo 40, which I take daily. And,
I take it a lot, too.
And what it's come from? Mainly from beets.
Is that right?
So,
I didn't even know that.
Yeah, and the research behind that product won a Nobel Prize, which I didn't realize before. Oh. But it's a beet extract is the principal thing that they make it from, and it's, of course, nitric oxide is one of the things. And that's the thing too. You know, there are a lot of different things that people take as supplements, but combined with the natural things and combined with a good diet, they work even that much better. And I wish I did all the things I tell other people to do, but I sure try. And beets are sure something good to have, as are greens. I grew up with a family that really didn't appreciate mustard and collards and things like that, and I have to give credit to my business partner, who's shown me that some of those good old southern dishes are just absolutely outstanding.
Oh, yeah. We've come up with a foolproof way of cooking beets. I chop them up into kind of cubes, usually sometimes little longer strips, put them in a stainless steel pan with just a little bit of olive oil added, and cook them pretty hot to begin with, medium heat, and then turn it down to low heat and get that going first before I start cooking anything else, because it takes longer for them to get really soft and perfect than the other things that you're cooking. I've learned that the hard way. And that's all you have to do. No seasoning of any kind, just the beets and a little bit of olive oil, and it makes a great dish.
I can't wait to try it. That sounds, you're making me salivate before breakfast here this morning.
Well, nothing's easier than that dish. You just have to make sure you leave them in there long enough. If you don't leave them long enough, they're fine to eat. You know, you can eat beets raw if you want to, but they're just so much more delicious if you let them get completely cooked and soft.
And that reminds me, earlier this week we had some toasted pecans, and that's another recipe that we absolutely love that you have on DirtDoctor.com. And I'm hoping it's going to be a good year for the nut trees out there, but that's something else that I've never found better than what you recommend.
Yeah, that crispy pecan recipe that we've got that has gotten simpler and simpler. I'm about to do a new batch of them. I probably will do it today. As a matter of fact, I promised my sister some. We missed Christmas and New Year's gift, and we're going to get together soon, and taking crispy pecans along with us will be part of the deal.
You'll be a big hit. they'll welcome you, as I'm sure they do anyway, but they'll welcome you even more when you come bearing that kind of gift. One plant I wanted to ask you about that I am not familiar with, but Japanese anemones. I think the variety was Alice Staub. I had a caller last week that said these things will get up to 36 inches tall and have a typical anemone flower. And you know, Lynn Lowry, of course, was one of the naturalists down in our part of the world that did an awful lot with popularizing native plants. But do you know Japanese anemone?
I think I grew it once a long time ago. It's a beautiful plant. I don't know why. It worked really well here. Didn't last, you know, as a perennial or anything, but it was pretty one season. I can't remember if I'm so bad about taking things out and changing things. That might have been what happened to it. But, yeah, I had some good luck with it. I need to make a note to try that again. It's a pretty plant. We have a little anemone that grows as a wildflower, too, I think probably ought to be used more. It's much smaller, but it's a cool little plant, too.
We do as well. In fact, that's what we call it, a real harbinger of spring, because that's always the first thing in my yard and actually along the roadsides. Roberta and I walk the roads over in her part of the hill country on a regular basis, and it's always the first one. And the lavenders to purples are always the most prominent, but the whites and the pinks, that's the first thing that shows up, and mine come back every year, and I guess I really haven't dug them up. I don't know if they have the same little bulb or corm that we get that for people to plant in bulb gardens, but
they're
sure pretty.
What it is. Yeah, people, you know, had asked me, you know, how to control them and spray them and kill them. I'm like, why in the world would you want to do that? Nothing's prettier than those little things. Yeah, they come up, and I've noticed them coming up in some people's yards, turf areas, driving around in places that aren't being very well maintained. So they seem to be very carefree.
You're describing my yard, not very well maintained.
No, I think it's a good wildflower. I think it's really pretty.
And if you watch them after the petals fall, when they go to seed, they make that little, and it's, you know, it's within 3 or 4 inches of the ground, but it's real easy to harvest a seed, and you know it's ready to harvest when you just rub it with your thumb and all the seeds start falling off. So it's an easy thing to spread around to other areas, and seems to do for me equally well in sun or shade.
Yep. Well, I hope it stops raining here pretty soon so I can do a little more gardening and catch up. I'm always behind, it seems, but it's nice to have the moisture too.
Oh, it's just, there's something magical about rainwater, and there are lots of different theories and all about what it is, from the spin theory to the fact that you get more nitrogen, especially if you've got lightning, but rainwater is just truly, truly magical, and I tell you what, looking at the way our part of Texas is developing, I'm telling people, you better be planning on rainwater catchment, because I see the day coming when groundwater is going to be either unreliable or, you know, so highly regulated through, you know, watering restrictions and things like that. The fun thing about rainwater is, you know, you don't have to pay any attention to what the authorities say. It's your water to use when and how you want. And it's something that we're really promoting. And, of course, like I say, y'all have lots of surface water up there, but as far as water for the garden, for the pets, for everything, I still think rainwater is just something that more people and more businesses need to get into.
Well, it's available now until the government tries to do something else. Say, I know we're about out of time, but one thing I was going to ask you real quickly. I'm having trouble figuring out how to buy the nematodes from the hydro gardens. When I do hydro gardens nematodes, I end up on a website that's dead. It's available for purchase, in fact. How are you guys getting a hold of those nematodes on a blue sponge these days?
I will get you a phone number, and that's something that one of our managers usually takes care of that I don't worry with, but I will get you that phone number and text it to you hopefully in just a little while this morning. They're unpacking a big California truck out there right now. So when we get through with that, I'll get you that number, and be sure and use us as a reference. And I think they'll take good care of you. They're still doing the 1 million sponge and the 6 million sponge, and I think they even do bigger ones by request. And it's the same. They do more than one, but we like that blend because it's important. I studied nematodes, but they were more of the parasitic ones back in my college days. Yeah. And don't know as much about the beneficial ones, but I think it's largely almost a 1-to-1 ratio between the host and the nematode that goes after it. And so we get a blend, they call it Guardian Lawn Patrol, that I think has either 7 or 9 different species of nematode in there. Cause, for us,
I think that's the best way to go too, yeah.
Well, I will get that number for you, and let us know if you have any issues.
Well, I want this information as well, so I'll put it on my website, and you know, we'll have it available for people. Somebody was asking me about it on the show last week, and I during the break, I tried to pull it up myself, and I ran into a dead end. I couldn't figure out how to do it.
Well, when you talk to them, ask them, you know, how much they do in individual shipments. I know we have, you know, farmers and ranchers down here, they're going to treat big acreage, but I don't know how much they're encouraging, like, individual sales. What they can probably tell you is what nurseries are offering them for sale. Like I say, I'll try to get some information there, but I don't think they're really set up for, you know, one-on-one sales. But, again, don't take that from me. Ask them when I get you the number.
Yeah, and if that didn't work, I just need to figure out, you know, something else to recommend to people. Well, Nelly is right in my face right now telling me that it is time for her breakfast. So we might ought to continue this next week.
I think that's a very good idea. You give Nelly and Tater both a big pep for us. And, Howard, it's always a pleasure visiting with you, and we thank you for spending some of your Saturday morning with us.
It is fun. You guys all enjoy those healthy gardens out there. We'll see you next week.
We'll look forward to it. Thanks again. That's right. Mr. Howard Garrett, the Dirt Doctor. His website, dirtdoctor.com, best thing on the Internet, and just a tremendous wealth of information out there. You start looking through it, you're going to realize it would be a long, long project. See all the information that's on there. But like he says, up in that upper right-hand corner is a good way to keep up with it. And on his recipes page, you're going to find a lot of very, very useful things to look for at dirtdoctor.com. We've got a little time left now for some phone calls. I think Jimmy's probably got the lines open. Let's run our bottom-of-the-hour commercials, Jimmy, and we'll be back hopefully with a few phone calls.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right. Well, back to gardening, and Martha and John both want to continue conversation, so let's go back to the phone lines. Martha, you're first. Good morning.
Okay. Give you an old saying for the frost.
Okay.
February frost in April, and unfortunately, I've seen it happen too many times in these years.
We have as well, and we're not going to change it, but old Malcolm Beck used to say, if it weren't for the weather, what would we have to talk about?
Right. Any thoughts on getting amaryllis to bloom when you want them to?
Well, the most important thing with... And, you know, American amaryllis, which most people don't realize, are really the true amaryllis, and they can be planted in the flower beds, and they're just early spring bloomers every year. The thing that most of us grow and call amaryllis are actually hippiastrums that come out of South Africa originally. And the most important thing is to be sure that they get that rest period, late summer into the fall, and in their native environment, that dormancy is induced by drought rather than by cold. And if you don't force them into dormancy, your flowering is going to be a little bit disappointing. So that's one thing I would tell you. And, we will know more this year. We at the, we do the huge gift market in January every year. And one of the people we visited with was somebody that's going to be new to us as a supplier of amaryllis bulbs. But he was talking about some things that they do in preparing the bulbs, getting the bulbs ready to put on the market. And he said their bulbs continue to produce bloom spikes for 2 or 3 or 4 months. So we're going to try to learn everything we can from him, and we're going to use amaryllis bulbs from a little bit different supplier in addition this year. And I hope I'll be able to tell you more after that. But the main thing I'll tell you right now is be sure toward the end of the summer that you really start withholding the water, and I mean zero water. Let those leaves shrivel and die and, just dry out completely. Hold that bulb in that dry state for 4 to 6 weeks, and then you can sort of control the time when it's going to bloom by when you warm it up. You know how we force bulbs as hyacinths and tulips and narcissus and things like that, and to a certain extent, you can do that with the hippiastrum. So you can't get them too cold, or it will hurt the bulb. But I believe he told us that the ideal temperature to hold them at is 47 degrees. And he said when you bring them out beyond that, they're going to start growing and start blooming. So if you properly put your bulbs through dormancy and then stored them at the right temperature, you can bring them out, 1 a week, 2 a week, 3 a week, and get them to bloom over, over really the entire early spring time. So it's fun talking to somebody who is a true specialist in amaryllis, and We're going to apply some of the things that he told us, and we'll see how it works out.
Oh, sounds good. One more question. You used to talk a lot about things going on with a show form for that was called Blue Rainbow. I haven't heard anything about it. What happened?
Now, ask me that question once again. Talk about
They were going to. We're looking for a family when they first started.
The Blue Ranch. Yeah that's
Ranch.
We need to ask.
Okay.
Yeah, we need to ask Howard Garrett about that. That was his project that he was involved in, and we haven't had time to get up there or anything. I think he really helped them set it up. And last time I asked him about it, they were well underway and had selected a foreman for the project. But, as I'm sitting here, I'd write down my notes on a little pad of things that I want to remember to ask Howard about. And I'll make a note for next Saturday to ask him about the Blue Ranch and see how that's coming along.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to hang up and go look for my asparagus.
Well, you do it, Martha. You have a good weekend, and we'll talk again. And we'll move on and talk to John. Good morning, John.
Good morning.
Good morning, sir.
Okay, I've got four questions real quick, if you don't mind, sir.
Absolutely. Go right ahead.
Okay. My wife likes the boxwoods in the pots.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like we've had some over the years that kind of were just nicely rounded without any trimming. Do they mm-hmm. take on the size of the pot when you plant them in a pot?
No. They eventually you can bonsai them, you can stunt them, but that's not going to happen until they become root bound, and that's usually. You know, that just depends on the relationship between the pot size and the plant size. But, no, in general, shaping is done by pruning or shearing. Pruning is, going through and just selecting very carefully individual branches. Shearing is just cutting everything back to one size. But most of the ones that you see have had some pruning and some shearing, and that's contributed to their size. They can be topiaried when you look at English gardens and things like that, where they have things that are really sculpted to a given shape. That's the result of shears.
Yeah, she loves the topiary. Mm-hmm. Okay. I live in Magnolia, and I have a horrible problem with yard rats, especially those with horns on them. And they killed 3 magnolia trees with their scraping, and it just uh-huh. really mad. But I also want to have some kind of garden, and I've been doing something in pots, but I have to build planters around them to protect them from mm-hmm. Those awful creatures. Anyhow, I'm wondering what size pot is the minimum for a healthy tomato plant?
There really is no minimum. It comes down to a matter of being able to care for it. And of course, the smaller the pot, the more quickly it becomes root bound. The more root bound it becomes, the faster it dries out and the harder it is to keep things watered. So, if you're growing, there's some little dwarf tomatoes, Tiny Tom and another one called Tumbling Tom that people grow in hanging baskets. But there's some little ones, and you can get a small to medium-sized fruit, literally growing those in maybe a 10-inch pot. But then you get to some of the indeterminates, like the Sweet 100s and the Sun Gold, which I love so much. Anything smaller than a whiskey barrel is going to frustrate you there. So you're going to have to match your variety to the size of pots. And as long as you choose some of the more compact varieties, probably the most popular plant to grow on a porch is appropriately called patio. And you can get a nice plant on it, probably in a 10 to 12 inch pot.
Okay. But, well, I like the Juliet. My wife likes the Roma. Is there a Roma that is a sweeter variety than just the Roma you typically get?
There are lots of varieties of Roma out there. There's one called San Marzano is one of the popular ones. They're difficult tomato for me. I don't know why, but in my garden, I've always had more problems with early blight on that than anything else. And I've heard that from other people, and yet other people, their gardens just thrive. Their Romas just thrive. So I'm not sure I'm the best person to ask about that. But if I were growing Romas, I probably would want to have them in at least a 12-inch pot. Your Sun Gold, your Sweet 100s, you're going to want a 15-gallon container minimum, you know, for those, because they're indeterminates, and they're just like a giant vine, and they'll just keep on growing. And you want to be able to water them adequately and properly, so you can't put them in too small a pot.
Okay. I'm probably will do, like, I think I'll get big enough pots. I was just hoping I could do something smaller with them. She also likes citrus trees, and mm-hmm. we've got them in pots on the back patio. But again, our unfriendly neighbors come and chew on the leaves. And
right.
I was wondering about putting in a blender a hot pepper sauce and spraying with them. Have you seen any problems?
And no problem at all. And you may actually be able to find something like that. A company called Maestro Grow used to make a garlic pepper tea. And if you're listening a few minutes ago, Howard gave his recipe combining garlic and peppers, you know, as a spray for various things. And it's good. You have to do it frequently, but it still works if they aren't too hungry. The problem with the summer we had, it was so hot and so dry, there were so little natural browse for them. They were especially bad in the gardens this year. I'll tell you what I have done. I've got my yard pretty much deer-proof now. I built an 8-foot fence around probably a little over an acre of ground, so my problems aren't what they used to be. But on the trees, I would take either two or three or four, depending on the diameter of the tree, just old iron T-post. And just put them up against the trunk, a piece of baling wire around the top, around the bottom, and they don't want to rub the velvet off. They don't like rubbing on metal. They look for that bark. They look for that tree, and that's where you get your girdling that you had on your magnolias and that we have on all kinds of trees. But I, for as long as I was fighting them in my yard, I would put that up around the middle of July and leave it up until this time of year when the rut's passed. And it pretty much totally solved the rubbing problem for me.
Yeah, that's good. And that's what I'm going to have to resort to. I know that. It's just kind of a pain. Last question. Palm trees, they took a hit with the freeze, and the fronds are brown. How long should I leave those? When should I cut them back, and how far should I cut them back?
Cut them back anytime you like. And are you talking now about cycads, like the so-called sago palms or the true palms?
Both.
Okay. On your cycads, just cut off any brown foliage. They need whatever green is there, so if you end up trimming just half of a frond off, it's what's brown is not going to become green again. On your true palms, you might as well go ahead and cut back anything that's damaged. The true palms, what you really have to do is watch that spot right in the center, because the only live part of your upright palms, now this doesn't apply to pygmy date palms or Mediterranean fan palms, but the only part of that trunk that's alive is right there at the base where the fronds come out of. If that is brown and dead, if that central frond coming up out of there does not develop, the tree's probably not going to come out. Like I say, the Mediterraneans, they will branch from the base, but your windmills and your things like that, no. If that point is gone, and so many people are planting the Coccus plumosa, that's a palm that just isn't hardy here and should not be sold. But in general, if the leaves are brown on either cycads or true palms, go ahead and do all the trimming you like. It's just cosmetic.
Okay. Well, last question. I've got a palm that's like 12 feet tall. It was here when mm-hmm. we moved in. And I do watch that center of it.
Uh-huh.
And the hard trees that we got the last time. I put some blankets over to kind of help protect that. And I didn't care about the outside foliage because I know it will probably return. You're saying I can cut all that excess out right now?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And watch that center. And John, I'm going to let you go. We got to get one more break in here before the top of the hour. And we'll see if we have time for any more calls.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 1071.
Recorded commercials. That's run us up to just about 45 seconds left in the show. Martin and Jim are live today. Apparently, they've got a big celebration going on with banners and things like that. So you want to leave that dial set on KTSA right where it is right now. Thank you for joining me today. Of course, we do gardening again tomorrow from 8 till 11, followed by Dr. Dan Kirby and Your Pet's Health. But anyway, there's some storms roaming around the area. Looks like the Hill Country's getting some rain, but here in San Antonio, not much right now. But go ahead and get out and get your gardening done, because we may get some more before the rain's over. Once again, get out and have a great day. Get some planting done, get some weeding done, get some fertilizer down. I can keep you busy all day long. This is KTSA Radio, San Antonio, Texas.